Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
You get out there and get it first.
You guys are so naughty. Remember to vote, and let's get ourselves a new president on November 4th, along with our new Hinder record. Have a great night. Thanks for listening.
101.1 WRIF. WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Now.
It cannot take a while.
Welcome to the award-winning Night Call, the Riff's Phone-In Talk Show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much, and as usual, joined by Jalene Jordan. Hi, Jalene.
Hello, Peter.
You sick of the election?
Oh.
Oh!
You know, to the point
Stop!
Where... Yeah, really, it was like, I'm so sick and angry and annoyed and all of these things. I thought, ugh! Okay, one more night of this, and then Tuesday... Whew.
Really, I'm just annoyed.
Well, I'm just sick to death of it.
I mean, we've got to have some election reform and let this only go on like in Canada for 8 weeks and
instead of what, 3 years? Really, it's been at least two. Yeah. And tonight I saw this ad by, I think it was GOP Nation, I believe that's the organization that put it on against Obama. And it's a whole, I would say, 30-second television ad about connecting him to Jeremiah Wright.
Oh, no, that's their last. You know, I'm just waiting for OBL. Where's Osama bin Laden? Aren't they going to trot him out? And Osama bin Laden's going to say, I want my brother, Barack Obama, to win, and that'll do it.
Well, he's expected to make a statement. He did, 4 years ago?
Yeah. Kind of sunk.
John Kerry did say that he thinks that played a part in his...
So they're bringing back Reverend Wright. Well, that's really the race card that they're finally playing, because that's their only hope. I mean, the fear of the other. When you see these Palin McCain crowds, they're truly frightening. They have, there's some famous saying. I can't remember it right now, but they something about release and they're going to reap the whirlwind. Well, they've really released the fascist beast in this country. The fascist third are out there. And when you see these films of films, boy, am I dating myself? These videos of, these crowds, they're truly frightening. To have a U.S. senator who's running for president being called a terrorist and all this stuff. I mean, think about this. All that they have said, Bill Ayers, Reverend Wright, Drill Baby Drill, Joe the Plumber, Tito the Builder, terrorists, Joe Sixpack, Hockey Mom,
Maverick.
That's what they call themselves.
Okay.
And then these two are the least maverick-y people around.
Yeah, and I didn't see Saturday Night Live last night, but
I
think McCain made fun of himself or, the different types of mavericks. I didn't watch it.
Yeah, well, the Maverick family, which there's an actual
real family in Texas.
Yeah, and they despise the fact that Palin and what's the other guy's name?
McCain,
right, are calling themselves Mavericks, because the Mavericks have always been rebels, always been very liberal.
The family.
The family, to this day.
Throughout history, several hundred years, they have done some really progressive things. So, yeah, they think it's a slap in the face and wish they'd quit using it.
Now, I don't know what it is about Texas. When you're up here in the north, any of you listening in Texas on the Internet, let us know. But a University of Texas poll shows that McCain and GOP Senator John Cornyn, who is running for re-election, have comfortable margins of victory in Texas, as expected. Here's a surprising finding. At least that's what it says here in the Houston Chronicle. 23% of Texans are convinced that Democratic presidential nominee Barack Obama is a Muslim.
Can you even fathom that number? I mean, a quarter of the residents of that state believe that?
You know,
how dumb are they?
Well, yeah, how dumb are they? I mean, maybe we should just leave it at that, because, I mean, let me give you listeners
why?
Here in Michigan.
Why?
Well, we're listening around the world. Well, no. I mean, if you happen to believe that, don't repeat it, because you really sound stupid, and people will really think you're an ass if you say something like that. Let's see. The Texas numbers are unusual because most national polls show that just 5 to 10% of Americans still believe Obama is a Muslim, less than half the number of Texans who buy into the debunked theories. Now, you know, but the deal is, so what if he was a Muslim?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
What?
Well, so what? Oh, and get this, only 34% of Texans approve of Bush's job performance. That's amazing.
Yeah, when 8 years ago it was 70%, something like that.
Well, let me see.
Is that what it was?
Here.
I read that same article.
Yeah, well, no, when he was reelected, he got 70% of the vote, but that's not true anymore. Well, one of the things I was, you know, that they've tried to latch onto, they being Palin and McCain, right?
McCain.
He just got. They just got a big endorsement from Dick Cheney. I don't know if you saw that.
Oh, who wants that?
Well, they sure don't. Where have they been? They've been in an undisclosed location. Hey, if you want to join us, our numbers are 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
This is Night Call with me, Peter Werby, and Jalene Jordan. If you'd like to email us, calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. And you've been updating our MySpace page?
I have. Wow, Peter. I had a big day.
It's MySpace.com, Night Call Show. So it's MySpace at Night Call Show. And there'll be a podcast of all of this available by noon tomorrow. Now, one of the things, so the McCain-Palin ticket essentially has been just trying to throw everything imaginable at Barack Obama, having nothing to do with policy. Just smear after smear, lie after lie after lie.
Desperate.
Well, it could work. Like I saw some poll that said I think maybe even the majority of Americans believe that Barack Obama may raise our taxes. Doesn't matter how many times he says that he is going to restore the tax level what it was before Bush repealed or cut back taxes for the ultra wealthy.
Yeah.
Yeah. So 90% of Americans would either have no tax increase or would actually get a decrease.
Uh-huh.
And you can go to the Obama campaign site, and it'll show you under his campaign program that how much you will get back. Now, one of the things that they're yakking about continually is about redistribution of wealth. Well, I hate to break this to you folks, but redistribution of wealth, let me put it this way. Distribution of wealth and redistribution of wealth goes on all the time. Whenever wealth is created, it's got to be distributed. Right? And it's distributed according to any number of, I don't know what, social, political, legal, and governmental apparatuses. Okay? So, for instance, if you're making $100 a week and you go in and you tell the boss you want $105 a week, you're actually asking for a redistribution of wealth. You want $5 of the money that's going up to the owner and instead go to you, right? So that's a redistribution of wealth. Well, that's difficult, certainly as an individual. And historically, when people began to move in mass movements for redistribution of wealth, they were met by enormous force of arms. That is back in the 19th century and through the 1930s, when the labor movement said, we have to have a redistribution of wealth. We're creating this enormous wealth for this small sliver of the capitalist class who was hogging it all for itself. And here's some of the ways that wealth was redistributed. There was this huge battle to have the 8-hour day. Now, we say, wait a minute, how is that redistribution of wealth? Well, people used to work 12, or be forced to work 12 and sometimes 14 hours a day in order to get their pay. Say back then it was $20 a week. Maybe it wasn't even that much. So what they wanted was, instead of working 14 hours a day, they would work 8 hours a day and still get $20. So that's redistributing the wealth. And the bosses, of course, called out the National Guard. They called the police out. They called private armies out. They called goons. They did whatever possible because they were defending the wealth of their class. They were the owner class. And they didn't want anyone telling them what to do. It was, quote, their money. And how dare ordinary people, the class below them, because there wasn't hardly any middle class in the 19th century. I mean, there were merchants and some administrators and what have you. But nobody, you know, the vast majority of people that worked everywhere were workers. And they were at the whim and mercy of the owners. And the owners didn't have much of a heart. So you couldn't depend on their goodwill. They wouldn't say, okay, I'm making so much money, I'm going to have people work 11 hours a day instead of 12. But no, it had to be actually class warfare. And so the best apparatus for distribution and redistribution of wealth under the capitalist system is the government. Because then you don't have big battles in the streets. You don't have the National Guard firing on striking miners. You don't have the Chicago police shooting into picnics filled with steel workers. You don't have armies of unemployed marching into Dearborn, Michigan and being shot down by the Dearborn cops back in, I think, like 1932, stuff like that. As I've said a lot of times, 300 men and women were killed by in an attempt to unionize during the 1930s. And that was all about redistribution of wealth. When you have a minimum wage, that's redistributing the wealth. Because if you leave it to the market, people could wind up making $2 an hour, $3 an hour, like that. So you artificially raise the selling price of labor. And the same thing with unions. When unions say, well, we're not going to go from the market price of our labor. We're going to be making crap. We're going to be making nothing. There's so many of us, and we're just a commodity. Labor is just a commodity on the market. It's not human activity to the people that are purchasing us. It is a commodity to be purchased at the lowest price possible. So they're always trying to drive down the selling price of labor so that the distribution of wealth will go to them more so. But when unions come in, when minimum wage comes in, when all sorts of other things like that, the wealth is redistributed. Right? And that's a good thing. The other thing is, when you have impacted wealth, like has occurred over the last 30 years, beginning with Reaganomics, that really set the stage for this whole thing collapsing. What goes on here is that, they have something, and without even getting into all the supply-side economics. So they had this thing like the more money that the guys at the top get, the more they're going to invest in industry and businesses and create jobs, and it really will trickle down to us peasants. That's the theory, at least. Well, of course, it didn't. And what happened was this enormous impacted wealth by the small sliver of the population. And what they began doing it was using it as speculative capital. So they bid up the stock market to these astronomical prices. And hello, it was all not, there wasn't real value there. So it's all collapsing. And more is going to collapse, too. Wait till the credit card balloon begins to collapse. All these people losing their jobs, thousands. Hey, Julian, do you have that? There's in our email, there's something called closed. Do you see that?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, that is astounding. Absolutely astounding what how many stores and chains and all that are dropping off. All right, here's another redistribution of wealth. And by the way, it's never going to the average person. It's always going up. ExxonMobil posts biggest U.S. quarterly profit ever. Oh, wait a minute. Did I get this from the last four or five quarters? No, that's this one, October 30th. They earned $14,883,000,000. And revenue rose 35% to $137 billion. Well, we're all being gouged. I mean, are the people that actually think we're not being gouged? I mean, it's impossible on the face of it not to think that, because if we weren't being gouged, they wouldn't keep making more and more money. They would make the same amount of money. If the barrel price cost them increasingly more, and then they raised the price accordingly, they would make the same every single quarter. But they keep making more and more because they're looting us, which is a redistribution of wealth. Now, Barack Obama is not about redistributing wealth. Oh, that he would be. Oh, that we should have that. He's not a radical. He's not a socialist. He's not a leftist. I don't think he barely makes it as a centrist. Okay? And John McCain, when he starts saying that Barack Obama is a leftist and he and this whack job, far right wing religious nut running with him are centrist, I mean, that boggles the mind and essentially has just moved everybody one step to the left. Because Barack Obama is a centrist, and Palin and McCain are, they're farther to the right than Bush and Cheney. I mean, particularly Palin. And you're saying, oh, I'm calling names. I'm calling her a whack job. I don't know if I have.
Well, she is. She qualifies.
Yeah.
And I want to tell you, Peter, I looked up at 8 minutes after 11. That was the fastest that the phone lines have filled up in I can't tell you how long. I mean, they fill up, you know, by 11:30 usually they're full. Boom. People really want to talk tonight.
You know, though, I can't find this, but a Republican, somebody from the McCain campaign called her a whack job.
Oh, yes, I did see that. Yes.
So,
Much information.
Let me do this quickly because, you know what, I was actually going to let you folks do... all the talking. Good luck, huh? Now, I would consider myself a leftist. I mean, not in the sense. I mean, you got to be careful with labels. I don't want to associate myself with the authoritarian left that has dominated the socialist and communist alternatives to capitalism through the 20th century. Those are pretty horrible. And when I've said that government is the best manner to which to mitigate the excesses of capitalism, that's the opposite extreme. And obviously it didn't work because it collapsed. But I did this once before. I just wrote down what would be a left program. And at the time, it was the big issue was the war. But here, this is my program. And tell me which of these things, maybe... Jolene, you could tell me, which of these does Barack Obama believe in? Immediate withdrawal of all troops from Iraq and Afghanistan.
No.
Yeah, dismantle all U.S. military bases abroad.
No.
Ron Paul and Dennis Kucinich believe that.
Yep.
Cut the war budget in half, so-called defense budget.
No. Nope.
Cut the armed forces by half.
No.
Begin immediate negotiations for total nuclear disarmament and peaceful relations with all nations.
Not at all.
Okay. A crash program to build an alternative energy infrastructure. No.
No.
No. Decommission all nuclear plants immediately.
No.
No. Zero emissions and pollution or companies are confiscated without compensation.
No, he's still talking about clean coal technology,
yeah,
blah.
Yeah. A free single-payer national health care system.
He wants universal health care. He used to.
Yeah, well, he doesn't want it.
Did I lose track?
He doesn't want this. Marriage for all that desire it. Anyone who does.
No.
Right. End of capital punishment.
No.
Yeah. Make all elections government financed with no media ads allowed.
No.
Abolish,
certainly not.
Abolish lobbyists. Make their illegal. No. Make it illegal for companies to influence pending legislation. No. Let's see. Okay. Here, heavy taxation of the wealthy and corporations. No. $50,000 tax deduction.
No.
Free university education.
No.
No. This is mine. Where's Barack Obama on this? Where is he, Mr. Leftist? This is a leftist program. This is kind of what they would call a social democratic platform with small d. That the type of lots of this is already in place in Europe and places like that. Free university education. No.
No.
Yeah. Massive funding of public works for schools, roads, and rapid transit. That would get us out of the depression we're heading into.
No. I'd say no.
Yeah. Free postage for individuals.
No.
No. Minimum wage of $10, and for North American companies doing business in Mexico.
No.
No. Excess profits tax, which would return earnings to employees.
Oh, definitely not.
Raise social security benefits.
No.
No. All right.
At least he doesn't want to privatize it.
There's a left program, folks. That would be a massive redistribution of income. And you know what? The rich would still be rich. These guys got so much money that the rich would still be rich. They would still run things. We'd still have, but instead of a plutocracy, the rule of the rich, we would simply just have a simple oligarchy, the rule of a few, with, sort of the facade of democratic elections. But here, this is from another senator, and this is from a socialist senator, Bernie Sanders, who is an independent from the People's Republic of Vermont, as the right-wingers call it. So during President Bush's tenure in office, the gap between the very wealthy and everyone else has dramatically increased. While 6 million Americans have slipped into poverty, while median income for working families has declined by more than $2,000, while 7 million people have lost their health insurance, and 4 million workers lost their pensions, the highest income Americans have made out like bandits, which many of them are. This is from Senator Sanders. Now, that is massive income redistribution. When that many Americans slip into poverty, and that many Americans, or a teeny-weeny number of Americans, their fortunes are increased by the extent that they have, that's redistribution of income. In Bush's first 7 years, the top 400 individuals in America saw an increase in their wealth of $670 billion. That's redistribution of income. So that by 2007, the top 1% earned more income than the bottom 50%. Tax cuts for the wealthy, unfettered free trade, no-bid contracts, deregulation of every conceivable market, and a belief that markets are the best determinant of social policy have together brought about a massive transfer of wealth from the middle class to the very wealthy. So unless you're up there making $250,000 a year, you want to reaffirm by voting for McCain and Palin, this looting of the middle class, your self-destruction, it becomes, rather than your destruction. The backbone of the American economy, says Senator Sanders, for the past 50 years, a strong and prosperous middle class has been severely weakened by the extremist policies of this administration. The economic future for the next generation looks bleak. Do I think that the Lone Ranger in the form of Barack Obama is going to fix all this? I don't know. But I know one thing, that a continuation of what we have now. All right? So that's up to you, I guess, although I can't imagine. I was looking for something else in here, too. Maybe that's enough. There's so many people waiting to talk. By the way, I mean, I went by our local Citgo gas station?
Yeah.
219.
I know.
And I'll say, all right, let's get it down for our friends McCain and Palin.
I drove down to the DIA the other night, the Detroit Institute of Arts, for those who aren't from here, and I saw it for $2.11.
Yeah. Oh, man. So do you realize that the looting figures for ExxonMobil, if those would have been up there, like today at $4, say, and 40 cents, people probably would have even have stopped talking about McCain and Palin.
Right. Yeah.
So their buddies who have looted us, who have created this massive transfer of wealth, this massive redistribution of wealth. So they've taken it from us. They've stolen it from us in terms of these gouging oil prices, gasoline prices, and sent it off to their stockholders. That's the redistribution of wealth. I'm sorry, I just found this. I thought I did at least. Oh, yeah. In an article in Yahoo News, McCain camp trying to scapegoat Palin. You know, she's the reason that he's going to lose. A top McCain advisor told Mike Allen of Politico that Palin is a whack job. But then the author says, maybe she is, but who chose to put this whack job on the ticket? Wasn't it John McCain?
Yeah, and that small group of religious right-wing fanatics.
Oh, yeah, who believe, by the way, and got to get to your phones. The top leader of the New Apostolic Reformation, which extensive evidence suggests is Sarah Palin's chosen religious and political movement, C. Peter Wagner, proclaimed in 2006 that, quote, God has declared through his prophets that the wealth of the wicked will be released to the kingdom of God, and Wagner declared threateningly, the enemy's camp will be plundered.
Please.
So it sounds like Palin's on board with this looting deal. All right, let's take some calls. Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan, 313-298-WRIF. Here's Ben in Detroit. Hey, Ben, thanks for being our first caller. You're on the air.
Hello, Peter. How are you doing tonight?
Doing great. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, I've listened to you since I was a teenager. I'm 25 now. You've really, you know, helped shape a lot of my views on the world and just opened my mind up to a lot of things. So I just wanted to say thanks for that.
Well, thank you.
I wanted to talk to you tonight about something that I just really think's been, I haven't heard McCain or Obama talk about it at all. And I know we got a million different things going on in the world right now that are big topics, but I just thought it was kind of weird that, you know, we still have this war going on here, being the drug war.
Sure.
It hasn't been talked about at all. It has more, you know, U.S. citizens in jail than any, you know, other country in the world. Are supposed to be the freest country. I just, it's like I haven't heard it mentioned at all by either of the politicians. And I just think, you know, it's like a major topic that nobody's talking about at all.
Well, that's another way. That's another way income is redistributed. They take our tax dollars and they make criminals of citizens that want to change their consciousness. Adults that fully informed of the dangers that are inherent in any intoxicant, ship it off to this prison industrial complex. So, yeah, well, there's Proposition 1 in Michigan that would allow medical marijuana, and the repressive forces, the prohibitionists, are hysterical. I mean, what message does that send? I don't know what message it sends, but it sure might help a lot of sick people. Fortunately, that's winning 2-1. Yeah. So, all right. Thank you very much. Appreciate your call. 313-298-WRIF. Here's Zach in West Bloomfield. Hi, Zach. You're on the air.
Hi. How you doing?
Good.
I just wanted to quote, you know, an actor. His name is Matt Damon, about Sarah Palin, you know, and I kind of agree with it. So is my brother.
That's it.
The quote is that he doesn't want somebody running our country and having the nuclear codes that didn't believe in the dinosaurs ever existed.
No, she believes that dinosaurs existed. She thinks they existed, they coexisted at the same time with human beings, because she's this, you know, religious nutcase who thinks that the earth is 6,000 years old or 4,000 years old.
Yeah, 4,000, something like that.
Yeah, yeah. No, yeah, well, yeah, that's not the only reason. If you go to my website, Peter Werbe, werbe.com, and she has been pranked by these two Quebecois, these French-Canadians from Montreal, or Quebec City, I can't remember, but who called her and pretended to be the president of France, Sarkozy, you actually have to read the article about it to realize how many, you know, how uninformed she is and how she just doesn't get so many important things. Yeah, no, she's truly frightening. And, yeah. All right, Zach, thank you very much. Appreciate
what
it.
What more can you say?
Yeah, I don't know. Let's see here. Here's Liz in Ann Arbor. Hi, Liz. Peter and Jalene
hey.
With you. Hi.
Hi. Oh, man, I'm totally going nuts over Palin and McCain, mainly because I feel like the people who are choosing to vote for them are completely uninformed and are choosing to vote for them over still fundamental reasons and aren't looking at other issues. I mean, I'm an educator, and I'm taking courses, working on my master's degree, and there's people in my classes who are educators who, you know, most people would believe are pretty towards the left.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, well, my husband's in the military. I have to vote for McCain. I'm thinking, why? What is your rationale? And they're like, because he's a military man. He was in, you know, a prison for so many years. I mean,
well,
Obama seems to have more of a pro-military stance in that he wants the Iraq war to end, where over 4,000 people have died. I think I feel like you guys. I'm absolutely losing my mind at this moment.
Well, Liz, here's some more bad news for you. Because of this downturn, believe it or not, they're expecting tuition to increase. You're actually going to have deflation, probably. Of course, that would mean that it would be cheaper, but they're expecting the tuition costs to rise, particularly says, given the economic strain on state budgets, the pressure on them to shift the cost of education to students and families may prove irresistible. And that's why I was saying, if we didn't, weren't just watching our money go down the drain of these war budgets, we would have money for free college education for everyone. It wouldn't just increasingly send people off into post-college years with debts of up to $250,000.
I mean, I'm broke, and I make, you know, somewhere between $40,000 to $50,000 a year, but with a mortgage and working on my education, I'm not making ends meet. It's pretty ridiculous.
Well, unfortunately, that seems to be the direction of things. I was saying earlier about the next thing they're looking at is this credit card crash, where more and more people are,
settling, yeah. Doing settlements.
Consumers feel the next crisis, it's credit cards. And they said, first came the mortgage crisis, now it's the credit card crisis. After years of flooding Americans with credit card offers and sky-high credit lines, lenders are sharply curtailing both, just as an eroding economy squeezes consumers. The pullback is affecting even creditworthy. Well, here it says, lenders wrote off an estimated $21 billion in bad credit card loans in the first half of 2008 as more borrowers defaulted on their payments. With companies laying off tens of thousands of workers, the industry stands to lose at least another $55 billion over the next year and a half, according to analysts. This is incredible. All right, Liz, I don't know what's going to become of us. If John McCain has nothing to change this, that's the unfortunate thing when you look at people that are voting for him. I don't get it. I don't know. Maybe we should ask that. How about that?
Okay.
Thank you, Liz. Could we make a pledge, you and I?
Maybe.
You and me, which is you and me. I don't know.
You and me.
Never, you and me.
Yeah, wait, no.
Me. Drop the other person. Anyway, I can't.
I am going to make a pledge. You and I are going to make a pledge. I am, you and I.
We get people on here. You can call up at 313-298-WRIF and tell us why you are. Give me an idea. Tell me, real briefly who you are. Hi, I'm a person who lives in Lincoln Park, or I'm a person that lives in West Bloomfield, or a person that lives in Detroit, or Royal Oak, or wherever. We can tell what gender you are. I'm 27 years old, I'm 46 years old, and I'm voting for John McCain and Sarah Palin because I don't want to hear from Barack Obama voters. Okay?
Well, now, you're not cutting them off from calling the show are you?
But we
know why you're voting for Barack.
But I can't imagine what kind of ideas people have in their heads why they would vote for McCain and Palin.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you mean like the one, the caller we just talked to? She's worked with people who's...
Okay. All right, here's the pledge. We won't give him a hard time.
We won't?
No.
Okay, all right.
Let's
I have to be on my very best behavior then.
Yeah, absolutely.
You're asking a lot of me.
All right, yeah, okay. So here's our next caller. It's Bill in St. Clair Shores. Hi, Bill. It's Peter and Jalene on WRIF. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, yeah. I'm voting for McCain because... Not because I don't like Obama, it's because people have been very, they've been saying, hey, why are you voting for McCain? I was like, because I've been voting Republican all my life. And I'm all like, they're all like, oh, you're not voting for Obama because you're racist, but that's wrong.
How old are you, Bill?
I'm 15.
And you're
You've been voting Republican your whole life.
Well,
you're 15.
They have these mock. They have these mock elections.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I'm behaving.
Yeah. And Bill. So, but you.
Your parents are Republicans?
Yeah.
So okay. My parents are Republicans too, and I recovered.
We're arguing with them.
I'm not arguing. I'm just telling him I recovered.
Yeah.
You too can.
Bill. So why are you voting for him? We just need a few sentences.
Because the troops in Iraq, we need to finish what's going on there. And I'd vote for McCain because we're doing all right now. Well, not the economy, but have you seen the gas prices lately?
Yeah, wow. Okay, all right.
We're not.
Let me tell you something about a mock
responding?
Election.
We weren't arguing.
We're not responding.
We can't even respond.
No.
Okay.
So I, here I am. I'm like,
I should have brought my gag.
I'm like, I don't know. Let me see. How old was I? 14 years old. Okay.
Yeah.
And this very stern.
When you went to the polls?
No. Yeah, I was running Democratic all my life. No, except I didn't. So I was 14 years old, and I was, you know, in a district that's heavily Democratic, right?
Okay.
So we had a mock election, and I can't remember who the candidates were, but so it was a presidential. I can't remember which one it was. 14. I could do the math, but it would just scare everybody.
Halloween's over.
So we had, like, you know, big class, 32 kids in the class. Let me see if I can do the math. So I organized, like, 8 kids to vote for the Socialist Labor Party.
You did?
I had no idea.
See, he's always been this way, people.
I mean, I had no idea who these people were. And actually, they're not authoritarian socialists. I don't even know if they still exist anymore. So I ordered 8 kids. So they said, so the teacher says, so, you know, so we all did it. And they said, the teacher announced the results. And she said, well, we have 18 for the Democratic presidential candidate. And 6 for the Republican presidential candidate.
Oh.
So silenced, and I raised my hand, and I said, don't we have 32 voters here? And she says, 8 were invalid.
That's a great story. Oh, Peter.
I said, oh, my God.
See, you're the real deal.
Yeah. All right. So anyway, if you've been just suffering in silence, McCain supporters for weeks and weeks now, I've said everything I possibly could about McCain, and
response.
Yeah, so we're not going to respond. You just tell us. All right, here's Mike in Clarkston.
Might need a drink after the show.
Hi, you're on WRIF. Go ahead.
I just wanted to point out also. First thing, this is the first time I've listened to your show actually tonight, and I'm a complete huge supporter now.
Okay.
Now that I see that you guys are bringing light to a lot of subjects people are supporting unknowingly and uneducatedly. The one thing I want to point out, though, too, that I don't think people are noticing is that a lot of things that happen in the election is they get lost and don't realize that whatever president we elect is going to be fixing and repairing the mistakes of the previous president for most of their term, at least most of their first term.
I think all of their term, and even if they have 2 terms, I think that term as well, don't you think?
I'll tell you, Mike, I'm actually worried that that this 30 years of Reaganomics and at its worst under
the Bushies
and and the McCain is going to follow that path. Contrary to what he says, is I wonder whether we have whether we've dug ourselves in too deep.
Well, not only that, but we have to look at when we vote for a candidate is how are they going to take care of the mistakes, not what they're offering. You know, like Obama and McCain are both saying we'll do this, we'll change that, we'll do all this, but that's not anything they put in effect isn't going to even go into place for years and years and years to come. It's all about how they're going to be prepared to handle the mistakes and all the problems that Bush has created himself. And if you're going to, I'm definitely an Obama fan, and I wasn't at first. I was very skeptical at first, and then started looking into it and doing research on seeing how he would take care of some of the other problems that have happened 3 years ago, 4 years ago. And I agree with you guys 100%. If someone votes for McCain, they're just digging a deeper hole and putting the same problems that we've already been going through in a further spot where we can't fix them.
Yeah, and Obama wants to, he says he's going to raise the tax back to the level of people making over $250,000, raise the level of their taxes back up to what it was during the Clinton administration, because Bush lowered them. That's one of the reasons that we have this enormous debt. The country has enormous debt. We're going to be paying it off. Our kids are going to be paying it off. Our grandkids are going to be paying it off. And this was because policy that it once has these enormous expenditures on war, and rather than raising a tax that you would have to pay for it, these nut jobs lowered taxes for the ultra wealthy, which then just puts it all on the average person.
And I know a lot of Republicans who did darn well under Bill Clinton.
Yeah. All right, Mike, thank you very much. Thanks for being a first-time listener and caller. Appreciate it.
Real quick, I don't know if you saw this because it was on television, but there was a woman in Grosse Pointe that denied candy to children who wanted Obama as president. It was on the local news. Before the woman gave out treats, she would ask the kids who they wanted to be. the next president. If they answered Obama, they were denied candy. Local TV reporters were sent to the home, and the woman said blatantly that people have to be punished for their bad choices in life, and that apparently she also looked like Leona Helmsley.
Well, wait a minute. I think we've got Brandon from Taylor who wants to talk about the same thing. Is that right, Brandon? You're on the air.
Hey, first-time caller, first-time listener.
Well, thank you, Brandon.
Welcome.
Yes, two things. First thing is took the kids out trick-or-treating to a small suburb in Ipsy this weekend. And half the houses were not handing out candy. The half that were not were Barack supporters.
I'm sort of missing this. Are you? You're saying that
I'm totally undecided. I don't know who I'm voting for, but we're out trick or treating, and half the houses that were not giving out candy were Barack Obama supporters, you know, signs in front yard.
What do you make of that?
All the houses that were handed out candy were McCain supporters.
So what do you draw from that? What's the lesson
here? I don't even know.
Well, I'll tell you, let me ask Jalene. We didn't hand out candy.
I say the Barack Obama people were out, you know, getting cultured. I was at the DIA looking at art.
I was at...
partying. People were partying down.
We went and actually went to the houses of neighborhood kids that we know and gave them candy, and then we went off to La Taqueria Mi Pueblo down in the southwest side, and then we went to this wonderful art opening at something called Alley Culture.
We were art suits. We were, yes. What was it, the
Denali? We're culture vultures.
The Denali, yeah.
All right, well, don't let that make up your mind, Brandon. There's got to be bigger reasons than that. Here's some good reasons. The Bush administration has just been talking about handing out treats to corporate interests and wealthy people. And this is one of the things that's led to the economic mess that we're in. McCain, as far as I can see, would affirm those policies. This is called the last push to deregulate. Remember when they asked Palin, there was, you know, that, who did, was it Kathy Couric that asked her?
Katie Couric. Yes, Regis.
Yeah, whatever. I saw her once for about 2 minutes.
Katie Couric?
Yeah. Yeah. But anyway.
I think she's good.
They asked her, Katie Couric asked Sarah Palin McCain.
Okay.
When had McCain ever supported regulation? And then, you know, Palin had this moose in the headlights look that she gets. so
I haven't heard that one yet.
Yeah, and she said, I'll have to get back to you on that one.
Oh, yeah, gonna have to get back to you.
Back to you, yeah. But here, this is what's going on now.
I wonder if she ever got back to her.
I don't think so, because McCain...
We've done that before.
Yeah. Anyway, here's the story from the Washington Post. The White House is working to enact a wide array of federal regulations, many of which would weaken government rules aimed at protecting consumers and the environment, all before President Bush leaves office in January. The new rules would be among the most controversial deregulatory steps. You hear this word, deregulatory? That's why we're in the mess that we're in. The most controversial deregulatory steps of the Bush era and could be difficult for his successor to undo. Some would ease or lift constraints on private industry, including power plants, mines, and farms. And farms, of course, this is agribusiness. Those and other regulations would help clear obstacles to some commercial ocean fishing activities, ease control on emissions of pollutants that contribute to global warming, relax drinking water standards, and lift a key restriction on mountaintop coal mining. So they want to give it all away to their corporate buddies that have, not only have they been looting us, but now they're going to help them destroy the atmosphere. And these people are truly crazy.
More than it's already destroyed. Now's the time to stop it.
Yeah. I mean, if you're a mining executive and you're paying off these political horrors like Bush and Cheney and McCain and Palin to do your bidding, I mean, don't you live on this planet? Don't you live in West Virginia where they're destroying these mountaintops all the time? I don't get this. The Times a couple of weeks ago had an editorial about this called New York Times, Last Minute Mischief. Exhibit A is a set of six resource management plans covering 11 million acres of federal land in Utah. They would open millions of acres to oil and gas drilling and off-road vehicles, risking priceless cultural artifacts and some of the most breathtaking open spaces in America. The plans, each more than 1,000 pages, were dumped on an unsuspecting public in the last few weeks by the Bureau of Land Management. Environmentalists are suspicious of the Interior Department's recent proposal to revoke a long-standing, if rarely used, regulation that gives Congress and the Interior Secretary emergency powers to protect lands when commercial development seems to pose immediate environmental dangers. They want to revoke that. And they're talking about the Secretary of the Environment. He's pressing ahead with plans to scale back important protections required by the Endangered Species Act by eliminating some mandatory scientific reviews by the Fish and Wildlife Service. These people are, we are in the hands of crazy people. This is what happens oftentimes when species overpopulate. They have this, they wind up committing mad acts to sort of destroy themselves in order to bring it back to some balance of the population to the environment they're living in, the carrying capacity, as they call it. So maybe this is what's happening. They're just going to eliminate millions or billions of us with this idea that they'll be able to eke out just a few more million and billion out of the planet before it finally just succumbs. These people are horrid beyond belief, just absolutely horrid. All right, one of the things we're asking, and you can do this, you can call us at 313-298-WRIF, and if you're a McCain supporter, you can say why. In fact, I'm curious why. And tell us just real quickly who you are. Hi. I'm whatever significant definition, age I'm interested in, stuff like that. And why you're going to vote for McCain. And we are not going to,
We're not going to bash you?
Yeah. We're not going to bash you.
We're not responding at all?
We're not going to respond at all.
All right.
So let me see. Where are we?
Having a hard time facing that.
Okay. Here's Nick in Southgate. Nick, hi. It's Peter and Jalene on WRIF. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, I'm Nick. I'm 19, and this is my first time voting, So, I like them both. You know, I'm very independent. I agree with some, I disagree with some on both sides, you know. But I'm coming from the military. I'm voting for McCain.
How come?
And it's not because of the way the troops are run, because, I mean, a lot of the troops that are there really don't want to be there. You know what I'm saying? They're there because that's their job. That's their orders. They were told to jump, so they jumped.
Yep. You know? Yep, yep.
And, I mean, Bush is the commander. He's the puppet master. You know what I'm saying? That's what he is. And, you know, so I don't feel it's all about the military. It's just, I think that the way Bush has gone through this war is amazing. You know what I'm saying? He's taken so much crap and bashing and talk from everybody, you know what I'm saying, myself included. I think he's an idiot, you know.
Well, I was gonna say, don't you think he deserves it?
He's an idiot. I mean he can't spell his name correctly.
But Nick, this guy has put your life at risk and those of your fellow soldiers for the, well, I said I wasn't gonna argue, but go ahead.
Yeah, Peter.
It's cool. I totally see what you're saying, but you know what, when we're in that office, you know what I'm saying, because I went right after my 18th birthday, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And I was excited, you know, because you know what? I was the one who signed the paper. I knew what I was getting myself into, and I was of sane mind going in and saying, yeah, I'm going to go to Iraq.
Did you go to Iraq?
Actually, 2 days before I was supposed to go.
Yeah?
I was supposed to complete my advanced training after basic, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And we were cleaning the barracks, and they found out I had really, really bad asthma.
Oh.
I didn't know that going in, so they discharged me and sent me home.
Well, the only response I have, because how can we not respond, is glad you're here.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, Nick, thank you very much. Appreciate your opinions. And let's see, here is Marion. Marion is in Dearborn. Marion, thanks for calling. 313-298-WRIF. You're on the air.
Yes, Peter, Jalene, good talking to you.
Hi.
I just want to make a point to the people who are against single-payer health care is that in Canada, they have single-payer health care, and they've got a budget surplus as well.
Hmm.
So, well, I mean, why can't we do that?
We're broke. Bush has made us into a debtor nation. We've got this enormous debt, and it's going to get bigger and bigger. The war bill hasn't even come in. There's no money. There's no money for really anything unless we just print it up and give it all out to the corporations like it's being done right now. I mean, we're in a terrible mess, and I don't even think, you know, when people always think, oh, the Depression, 1929, the stock market crashed then, but the effects began to be felt over the nation, the United States, in the next couple of years, when things began spiraling downward. And we're arguing about which politician to put in. The economy is such, unless somebody steps up to be a Roosevelt, and McCain has no inclination to do that whatsoever, and certainly Palin doesn't at all. So that leaves it to Barack Obama. And so far, the plans that aren't in place, but they weren't with Roosevelt either when he got elected in 1932. But he was smart enough. By the way, that in terms of wealth, I mean, we're always bashing McCain and Palin for being this multimillionaire and a millionaire, you know, talking about the working people and dropping, you know, dropping her G's and all that. But that essentially Franklin Roosevelt was probably the richest man ever to enter the presidency. Or maybe, I don't know, maybe McCain would be giving a run for his money. But in any event, even if you have a lot of money, it's really whose interests are you looking out for? Like Bush, of course, was born on third base, and he thought he hit a triple, yet he always acted on behalf of the ultra-wealthy, people like himself, people like his father, people in his social and economic class. That's not what Franklin Roosevelt did. I mean, to some extent he did. He was afraid a revolution was going to come about. So he said, boy, I better make some reforms to capitalism, or people are going to start a revolution against capitalism. So we'll see what Barack Obama does. I'm assuming he's going to get elected, by the way.
Hopefully.
Right now, if you go to the front of the Yahoo page, they've had this Electoral College poll kind of bar graph or whatever you call it. He's got 355 electoral votes is from what they're...
Are you looking at it right now?
And no, this is... I just have it from memory.
Okay, because they reduced it a little.
Well, McCain's went down to 181, and it was 188.
Yeah. Oh, well. So, one of the things, you go to these right-wing sites, and they say, you know, it's all within the what do they call it, the percentage of error and
margin of error.
And, it's only like 48 to 44. Well, that may well be, but it's ultimately all about the Electoral College vote.
It is.
And right now, Barack Obama has a lock on it. I don't think, and unless, I mean, we talk about an October surprise, which hasn't come about. Could they, in fact, bring about a surprise tomorrow?
They could.
Well, these guys are so totally evil.
They are capable of just about anything.
Anything, yeah. All right, let's take one more call before our break. Let's see, here's Ron in Utica. Hey, Ron, you're on the air.
Hey.
Hey.
I just got a question because, I mean, from what I hear from people, you know, what people tell me, because I'm kind of undecided about voting, and I don't, you know, because I either hear from people who are all the way on the left or all the way on the right, and I just want to know where's a good place to get some non-biased information, you know?
Right,
you know?
Here.
Well, I don't know. You know, I don't bias. I think everyone has a bias. I think that the news media over the years has constructed this illusion that they're objective, and they're really not. And there's, to some extent, there's no. I mean, reality has an interpretation to it, and you I think have to make some sort of decision about what makes sense for you. I mean, what are you operating off in terms of decision making? And I mean, I've had people over the years say, boy, you know, you listen to me, you listen to Rush Limbaugh, how do I know who to believe? Well, I don't know. I mean, if I gave you the answer I thought, it would be, you know, I'd say, yeah, believe me. I don't know where you unbiased information. I don't know. I'm not even sure how to answer that, to tell you the truth.
So I'm really undecided right now, you know. There's, like, some things I like about McCain, some things I like about Obama. You know, I ask people about it, and they're either people, you know, the news stations either always bashing McCain, or you go, like, another news station, they're always bashing Obama, you know. It's never, like, just...
Well, tell me, Ron, just because we're trying to get some idea why people, because Jolene and I can't understand it, why, what is attractive about McCain as a candidate?
Well, I'm joining the Navy and by next year.
Mm-hmm.
And just from that aspect of, you know, just from that alone, and how he's going to support, you know, the troops, you know.
Well, I'll tell you what, and this is not, we said we weren't going to argue with anybody, that put in, go to like a search engine and put in McCain, put in veterans benefits. All I would say. All right, we got to take a break. Thank you. Good luck on your career choice. And we'll be right back. Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan, 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
Do we ever get any email?
We have a couple of emails.
I think you know, I hear you clicking over. I think you just made a lot of friends. You don't read them on the air.
No.
Okay, maybe we'll read a couple when we come back.
Yeah.
Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. We'll be right back.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more of your calls right after this. 101 WRIF celebrates the return of AC/DC to the Motor City with your AC/DC Perfect Playlist. Submit your AC/DC Perfect Playlist right now at WRIF.com. Then, this Wednesday from 11 a.m. until showtime, we'll be playing them back for you. Everyone whose list gets played will be in the running to win a pair of front row tickets for AC/DC's sold-out show that night. Plus, catch the concert replay on 101 WRIF Wednesday night right after the sold-out show.
Hello, this is Brian Johnson of AC/DC, and you're listening to Detroit's form of rock and roll. W-R-I-F.
Better training, better standards, better business. That's what the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, IBEW Local 58, and the National Electrical Contractors Association, NECA signatory employers, bring to each and every job. Through their state-of-the-art electrical industry training center in Warren, IBEW Local 58 and NECA signatory employers invest their own resources in training to ensure they deliver the most experienced and qualified workforce possible. They have a long history of commitment to being the best. More than 1,000 hours in the classroom and 8,000 on the job means better quality workers and better results for Michigan business. This team is experienced and constantly updating their training to remain leaders in the field. Contact IBEW Local 58 or a NECA signatory employer today for your next project. IBEW Local 58 and the Southeastern Michigan Chapter NECA signatory employers. Better training, better standards, better business, and partners in powering Michigan's future.
Radio, play us that song that makes us sing. Wake us up, make us dream. Take us on a trip to the wild, to the sea, to that tiny village war won't leave. And when the building has emptied and the lights have all dimmed, tell us that story with the happy end. And radio, one more thing. Sing us a song before we turn in.
And that's Radio Heard Here. Brought to you by the radio industry and this station to remind you that radio is heard here, radio is heard everywhere.
Did you know that 1 in 5 Michigan residents is living at or below the national poverty level? That means supporting a family of four on $21,200 a year. On November 13th, at the Voices for Action Poverty Summit at Cobo Hall, Michigan will launch a statewide effort to reduce poverty and maximize economic opportunities. Join keynote speakers Martin Luther King III and Governor Jennifer Granholm for an important discussion on this statewide initiative. Log on to Michigan.gov/poverty to register today. This message sponsored by the Michigan Department of Human Services.
Most WRIF contests are open to legal U.S. residents at least 18 years old. Winners may win only one contest every 30 days or every 6 months for prizes worth $600 or more. Employees and their family of Greater Media Detroit, its advertising agencies, and other radio stations in the metro area may not participate. No purchase necessary. Prizes are not transferable, and rules are subject to change at any time. Complete rules are available online at WRIF.com. Or at the WRIF studios during regular business hours.
Everything that rocks. 101.1 WRIF. WRIF HD1 Detroit. We're back
with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back to our second hour. Jalene Jordan is with me. Please join us, 313-298-WRIF.
Peter?
Yes.
We also have to do something called a legal ID, so it's 101 WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
You missed it. We did it.
No, we didn't.
We did, too.
We did?
We did.
Okay. I wasn't paying attention.
Okay.
No, but now we've got it doubly covered.
Yes, yes. We are golden. A line in the sand for same-sex marriage foes. Now, you may remember that the California Supreme Court okayed a gay marriage a little while ago. So while the battle over same-sex marriage has been all but invisible in the presidential race this year, thankfully, it's raging like a wind-whipped wildfire in California. Conservative religious leaders from across the country are pouring time, talent, and millions of dollars into the state in support of Proposition 8, which would ban same-sex marriage. They are hoping to reverse a California Supreme Court ruling in May that gave same-sex couples permission to marry, resulting in thousands of exultant same-sex weddings. Exultant same-sex weddings. Happiness. People so in love finally being able to express themselves within the body politic on a legal basis, and they're exultant. Well, these religious fanatics don't want that, do they? Similar marriage amendments are on the ballot next month in Arizona and Florida. California, they say, these are the religious nuts that want to make somebody else's business their own. They want to legislate their religious beliefs. I mean, why the hell don't they just get out of our lives? They say California sets cultural trends for the rest of the country and even the world. If same-sex marriage is allowed to become entrenched, there they warn there'll be no going back.
Oh, no.
Now, can anybody tell me, I've been married for a real long, long time, not to a man either, but a very nice woman.
Yes.
A lover.
Lovely lady.
Lovely lady. and I think marriage has a lot of important aspects to it, very important. But tell me how, if you oppose same-sex marriage, how that will harm marriage between a man and a woman.
Yeah, that's a very, very good question. I got nothing.
Yeah. Now, here is where this comes into play in another aspect. This is hate crimes down in 2007, but anti-gay crime is up. Hate crime incidents decreased slightly last year, despite a surge in crimes targeting gays and lesbians. Now, why would this be? Why in the world would this be? Maybe because they're exultant over their weddings, but you know what? You have these religious creeps going around damning them and talking about they're bringing on the end of civilization, that they're, that people act out the homophobia they have, and the only reason that, it's almost always men attacking gay men or gay women. I mean,
Not even almost always. I would say 99%. I can't even think of one where it was a woman.
Can you imagine a heterosexual woman attacking gay women or gay men in a hate crime?
No.
I don't think so, right.
I think most heterosexual women think about it.
Well, I have no idea. But
they go, that's just sick. My God.
Yeah. but in any event, I don't want to go into psychoanalyzing why people are homophobic, but it ain't good, I'll tell you. I don't mean the results of it's not good. The psychological motivation for why people are homophobic and would actually carry out a hate crime against somebody because of their sexual orientation, it doesn't say much about you, and it doesn't just mean that you're mean either. But in any event...
Ignorant?
No, it means you're probably dealing with a lot of repressed homosexual feelings yourself.
Absolutely. Yeah,
there you go. More than a third of all hate crimes were characterized as vandalism or property destruction. Intimidation was the second most common hate crime, followed by simple assault. But the ones against and the targets, blacks, Jews, and gays, were the most frequent victims of hate crimes. Nothing new there. But there's an increase in anti-gay hate crimes. But what happens here with these campaigns against allowing people who love one another and want to be commit publicly and legally and be recognized as full human beings when these religious fanatics attempt to make their religious beliefs public policy.
Yeah, right.
That's what sets the context for a hatred against people that should be getting full respect. There's very few of us who don't know gay people. Many of us have gay people in our families. I don't have any gay people. I don't know, not that I know of. Do you know? You don't want to talk about that on the air?
What, do I?
You have gay people in your family?
Absolutely.
Oh, you do?
I do.
Okay, well, there you go.
In my immediate family.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I don't I don't have any in mind. But still, that when someone is, at a, what, I don't even know.
Where
why are
going,
we still
Peter?
Talking about this in 2008?
What
get over
is
it.
Is this?
I know.
God.
All right, let's get back to our folks. But this is it. These campaigns against gay marriage are what fuels anti-gay hate crimes. So, there you go.
Live your own life.
You have to do
right?
It. Yeah, forget about it. These are people that, these are busybodies, people that aren't taking care of their own business.
Yeah.
So they interfere in the business of other people.
Right, overly concerned with the sexual activity of others. Well, you know what? Go get yourself some and quit complaining.
Yeah. Do you know what they do? It makes me sick. Oh, guys, not women. Women, I like to watch that
yeah.
on the porn films. I
really? The same things you do. Yeah.
All right. One of the things we're doing here is taking McCain callers. Like, it's absolutely, I can't conceive of why anyone who's making less than $250,000 a year would vote for McCain. Anybody cares about the environment, women's rights, I don't know what, the economy, the war, anything. It's absolutely inexplicable to me.
So far, all we've heard is
military.
Yeah. Yeah.
And okay. Even they didn't sound real strong. Neither of those guys.
No,
but we're not going to argue with you. Maybe this guy. This is Todd from Southgate. Todd, you're on the air. Hi.
Well, how are you going to argue with me, Peter? You said you wouldn't do that.
Okay, go ahead.
Who's this?
All right.
Todd.
I would like to answer why I'm voting for McCain first, and then I'll give you the whole homosexuality argument after that. Number one, I think McCain can bring us energy independence a lot easier and faster than Obama ever would. And number two, this is probably one where you guys are going to get mad at me for. But I think it's pretty obvious with his past relationships that he is, in my opinion, very racist and very anti-American.
Who?
Obama.
Obama's yeah. racist?
Yeah. All right.
Yes.
We're not going to argue. All right. We're not going to argue. Laughing is arguing. Laughing is arguing. Stop.
Come on. It's not arguing. Laughing's not arguing.
All right. All right. So what's, what do you, tell me your
that
twisted
is the
view.
Funniest
I mean,
thing
your,
I've heard all day.
Tell us your view on homosexuality.
Well, the reason that I'm against gay marriage would primarily be, I think it's bad for the family structure. And
why?
I think that's been proven scientifically that it's better for a child to have a man and a woman and its wife, obviously being the mother and the father.
Well, wait a minute. That may or
I
may
know.
Not be true.
I
mean,
know a
wait.
Lot of families with two mommies and two daddies.
Me too.
And these kids are brilliant and well-adjusted and smart and loved and loving.
That's true. And we also know, and I'm sure you do, Todd, as well, whether there is a mommy and a daddy where it is just the family from hell.
From hell? I know more of those.
Yeah. So, I don't know. I don't think you can make any generalizations. And say it was true. Say that, in fact, that in a well-adjusted couple, if you had a well-adjusted two men, well-adjusted two women, and a well-adjusted man and woman, all who were loving, had loving relationships, were committed to child-rearing and all of that, that somehow that having models of male and female were, quote, better. Well, it's not like that. We know from experience, it's not like gay couples raising kids wind up to be some horrible situation or some destructive society-breaking institution, right? I mean, if anything, if there's any statistic out there for that or any psychological study out there, it's probably fairly minimal, don't you think?
Oh, no, I don't think so. I think common sense would dictate that a man and a woman in a town's life is natural, first off. That is more natural, because obviously you need...
Wait a minute. You hit it. One, first you said natural, then you said more natural. We know that homosexuality is natural. How do we know that? Because it happens. In fact, most societies try to suppress it. Very many societies.
You're killed for it, right?
Very, very violent means. On the other hand, there's any number of tribal peoples that affirm it, and they usually it's men, and the men have special roles. And American Indians, they had squaw men who actually performed certain roles within Plains Indians, I believe. So we know that homosexuality is, quote, natural because it occurs all over the world, right?
Just because something occurs doesn't mean it's natural, Peter.
Well, you know, I'll tell you what. There's, mallard ducks, when they don't find mates, they have, they call them bachelor buddies. There's homosexual activity occurs among some mammals. Mammals? Yeah, mammals.
If it's natural, then...
That's a crazy... We're saying it's not natural. And, you know, do you think it's natural to fly in airplanes and live in skyscrapers? There you go. All right. Thank you, Todd. I knew that would stop him.
Oh, God.
I mean, really. Let's see here. Here is Gabe. Gabe's in Rochester. Gabe, hi. It's Peter and Jolene on WRIF. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
Good.
I gotta tell you, I have a first-time listener, and I gotta tell you, I stumbled onto a gem tonight.
That what? So,
stumbled onto a gem tonight.
Oh, okay, well, thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
The show is great. I'm loving it so far.
Thank you.
Yeah. Hey, I got an email a couple days ago. It seems to be a chain email that a lot of people I've talked to have gotten it to, and I think it has a lot to say about why a lot of the people are really supporting McCain.
Why is that?
And it has to do with it all goes back to just the religious aspect and how all the right-wing, conservative, real religious group of the country is pushing for that side of the debate. And I'm gonna read a part of it here to you real quick, if that's all right.
Okay, it was not too long. Just
no.
Give us the headline, maybe. Yeah.
All right. It says, according to the Book of Revelations, the Antichrist will be a man in his 40s of Muslim descent who will deceive the nation with persuasive language and have a massive Christ-like appeal. Prophecy says people will flock to him, and he will promote false hope and world peace. And
wait a minute, Gabe. They say that's what the Book of Revelations says?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it's absolutely absurd. And it drove me wild when I read it. And I actually did some research on it. And nowhere in the Bible, anywhere, does it say anything about a list of things that the Antichrist will be. And it's even more absurd when you look at it more that the Book of Revelations was finished at the end of the 2nd century. And Islam wasn't even founded till the beginning of the 7th century.
Right.
So, I mean, just this whole propagation of this, all these religious fallacies that are being spread around are just really creating that vote. And all these religious people see this and, they read something like that.
Well, you know, Gabe, I think a lot of it is that these people are so fearful. That they're terrified, and the idea, you know, I think a lot of it does come down to race. Even though that Barack Obama is like an American success story someone that's lived and created the American dream for himself beyond anyone's expectation. I mean, the idea that an African American child or someone who is mixed race, more accurately, could actually become the president of the United States or in contention for it is an absolutely amazing story that affirms the story, the mythology.
The American way.
Yeah, the American way, the American dream. But I think people that are in such dire straits and are so fearful of the future that they would rather stick with something that they know, no matter how disastrous it probably is going to turn out to be, because it's just an extension of what has been destroying their lives now, that to link on to the other. I don't know if you've seen these videos of McCain supporters at these rallies. They're just filled with hatred and yelling that Barack Obama, the centrist U.S. senator from Illinois, that the same place that Abraham Lincoln was. He is in Abraham Lincoln's seat, Barack Obama. They're calling him a communist, a socialist, a Muslim, a terrorist. These people are so divorced from reality, but rather than just saying that in a totally contemptuous way, you have to think, why are so many people in this in this state? And it all comes out of this tremendous fear, which then translates into rage. You know?
Absolutely.
Yeah, and that's the fascist mentality, by the way. That's are the people. That's the people that that can kill their neighbors. That's the
keep listening. We say that a lot.
Well, when you think about how could Germans actually allow what happened to their neighbors, their Jewish neighbors, or their political leftist neighbors? What happened to them? How could they allow that? Or how could Serbs do what they did to Bosnians and who lived with them? Well, all it is relegating them to the category of the other, with a big capital O. That one, as McCain said frighteningly during one of his losing debates.
Yeah.
And it's people that have no courage whatsoever. I mean, they'll take even personal risks a lot, but inside they're just absolutely terrified. That translates into rage. It's really frightening. And the McCain-Palin campaign has purposely released this demon into the body politic. And so when Barack Obama wins on Tuesday, we're going to have a situation that is going to be worse than what how they reacted during the Clinton administration. They can dust off their little bumper stickers about, I love my country, but I don't trust my government. Right. Somehow, during the Bush administration, they didn't fly those. Okay, thanks for listening, and thank you for calling, and please do both again. Thank you.
An email from William: for these religious freaks to spend millions on an issue that harms no one in any way, talking about Proposition 8 in California, and that harms no one in any way, shape, or form, is insanity. Why not instead pour the millions into food banks and do some good for a change? To even have this on a ballot at this time or any time is only proof of how insane many Americans are.
Yeah, many of you may not know it, but 40 years ago, in many states in the South, it was illegal for someone of African descent to marry somebody of European descent. I mean, what a disgrace in this country.
It's hard to believe.
Past mid-century, in the 20th century, it was illegal in states like Virginia and Mississippi and South Carolina, places like that, for a black to marry a white. How disgraceful that was.
Yeah.
And for those of you who think, oh, we can't let gays marry, well, it's going to be that same disgrace. And in 40 years from now, people are going to be shaking their heads and saying, why didn't they let men marry men?
They'll be just as embarrassed as we are about that. Doug in Ontario says, what makes you think this election won't be rigged like the last two? Well, do you really think Obama will be allowed to win this election? And if Bush can steal two elections, McCain can steal one.
Yeah, well, they're certainly up for that, mostly through vote suppression. But where didn't somebody write in from Royal Oak, Russell from Royal Oak?
Let me find that one here real quick.
See, they can't steal millions and millions and millions of votes. Greg Palast says the Democrats always have to be big because there's this massive vote suppression. These machines are rigged. So if Obama just has to have a big enough vote and he can do it. They can't, it's not like Obama's going to win overwhelmingly and somehow they'll steal like 15 million votes. They're not going to do that.
Russell in Royal Oak, if touch screen voting is implemented in Royal Oak and I press the Obama button and the machine flips it to McCain, then I'd be voting for McCain. But that is the only way I'd be voting for those two mavericks.
Well, I think on my website, is that still on there? Oh, yeah. You can go, you can go to Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. Hey, by the way, this is just unabashed. I get no money for this whatsoever. It's sort of an ad. But it's nonprofit. There's a group called Syracuse Cultural Workers, and I'm looking at my site now. Did I just give it Peter Werbe? Yeah, I think I did. WERBE.com. It says, forget Hallmark and Walmart. Get your holiday cards and gifts from the Syracuse workers. Great gifts, good cause. So take a look at that. Also, there is the Sarah Palin video getting pranked by a couple of Montreal DJs who just make a total fool of her, which is not real difficult. But if you go down, I got to get rid of all this stuff on. Homer Simpson tries to vote for Obama. So you can see that.
Right. Kimberly in Nashville wrote in and is listening for the first time. She's a fan. And says, Peter, you were just saying exactly what she was getting at. Obama's a black guy who has done much better than many people think a black man should do. And she's willing to bet those same people would claim to not be prejudiced.
Yeah. All right, 313-298-WRIF. We're looking for McCain voters and why they would vote for McCain. And we're not arguing with you. We've made our arguments over the last 2.5 years.
But if,
so.
But if it's something besides McCain, we can argue.
Yeah. The other thing is that Todd from Southgate was saying that, and that's one of the arguments against gay marriage, is that there's not proper male and female roles for children. So you're going to make it a constitutional, you know, Palin supports a constitutional amendment to the United States Constitution.
To ban gay marriage.
Yeah. By the way, what they call the bourgeois revolutions, this was the bourgeoisie, the emerging bourgeoisie beginning in the 16th century, carried off these revolutions against the aristocracy and the divine right of kings. And what it's been since then is a spreading of democratic inclusion. Because, I think I was saying this last week, at the beginning, remember the U.S. Constitution permits slavery, permits the slave trade, they could still import human chattel from Africa up till 1803, only white propertied males could vote, so it began to extend the franchise, extend democratic rights, and it's been a hard struggle. And to abolish slavery, look what that cost us, right? These conservatives who wanted to conserve the institution of slavery were willing, the biggest traitors in history, in American history, you know, the Confederates, the Confederate South, and were willing to allow hundreds of thousands of Americans to die because they wanted to maintain slavery. They wanted to conserve slavery. Remember, that's what they wanted to conserve. The original conservatives wanted to conserve monarchical rule in the United States. They wanted to continue to be subjects of England. So that's the conservatives there. They wanted to conserve the right of white propertied males to be the only one that could select our representative. They wanted to conserve slavery. They wanted to conserve only men voting. They wanted to, and on and on. The conservatives have been on the wrong side of every social question since the beginning of this country, since its origins. It was the radicals that always made changes. It was the radical abolitionists. It was the radical feminists. And I'm not talking about the 1960s. I'm talking about 1880s. And it was the radicals that always pointed out that these wars that the United States fought in most cases were based on lies and just imperial acquisitions, like the Mexican War, Henry David Thoreau, people like that that opposed the Mexican War, Mark Twain, who opposed the Spanish-American War. All of the socialists and labor leaders and people like that that opposed World War I that was based on total pack of lies as well, and on and on and on. The labor unions formed by radicals. It took radical action to change America, radical ideas to change America. Conservatives never changed anything. They always wanted everything like it was. In fact, that's really what they want. White maybe they'd extend it a little, but white propertied males would have just suited them fine. Except we had to struggle, and it was always won in blood, unfortunately. Well, we don't have to do it with this social revolution that allows our neighbors, our kids, our relatives, our friends, our co-workers to simply be recognized, I'm talking about gay marriage here, as having the same human qualities of everyone else. And Todd said, well, you know, if you have two women, two mommies, that does, where's the male model? How many single female households are there? Yeah?
Many.
So what are you going to do? Maybe you have like a Reverend Moon kind of deal.
Hey, how about a blow-up man? You know, like a blow-up doll, and they can just sit there in the corner. What do you think, honey?
Two questions. One, why are you supporting McCain? We won't argue with you. The other stuff, we will. How would gay marriage hurt you? How about that? How would it hurt you? I don't like it. Well, too bad. Who cares what you like? You can't restrict somebody else's right to do something that doesn't affect you directly at all. Or, how would it hurt the institution of marriage? I'm married. I'm a longtime married guy. I can't imagine how it would hurt me. I can't think of a single reason. I mean, we're childless, so it doesn't matter. If I would have married a guy, I would have been childless, right?
So maybe.
Yeah. Well,
not necessarily.
Could have adopted. All right. Here's Ken. Ken's in Ferndale. Fabulous Ferndale. How you doing, Ken? You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
One of the main reasons I have to say that I'm voting for McCain right now is in the beginning, when all this stuff really started blowing up, as far as the candidates and all that, I started looking at it, and I had an open mind on both of them. Then I started hearing a lot of stuff about, oh, well, there's going to be, Obama's trying to make a socialist government, this and that. And what I did is I actually went online and went to the socialist's website.
Uh-huh.
And I can't give you the issues hand in hand right now. I don't have everything in front of me, and it's pretty late right now. But you take Obama's plan. You go to the socialist website, take out the word socialist, communist party, you're going to see more similarities than you're not.
So my biggest... Give me an example.
He's tired, it's late, Peter.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, because there's nothing like that. I know
one?
I'm arguing with you, but yeah, one example.
Okay, as far as taking from the rich and giving to the poor, which is one of the main things that I've heard as far as the economy and the tax bases go, that right there is a socialist idea. Okay, now I have no problem with raising taxes or making a flat rate tax where everybody pays 25%. If everybody pays a flat rate tax, I'm going to pay less. I mean, I make under $50,000 a year. So as far as what's going on with Obama's plan, this isn't going to affect me. This is going to affect my job.
No. Never mind. I said I wasn't going to argue. All right, let's leave it at that. All right, thank you.
Thanks for calling.
Thanks, Ken. Yeah, by the way, if anybody else wants to call in and take issue, please feel free. 313-298-WRIF.
Yes, you can argue.
You can argue. We're not going to argue. So that's kind of the thing. He's a socialist argument. I talked about that at the beginning of the show. If you missed it, hey, an iPod will be available by noon today.
The podcast.
Yeah, the podcast. Yeah. Here's Ron in Commerce. Ron, hi. It's Peter and Jolene on WRIF. Thanks for joining us.
How you doing, guys?
We're doing great.
I got a little story to tell you. I'll try to make it brief and quick as I can.
Sure.
I'm a plumber. I have been for quite a few years. I just noticed recently, you know, just about everybody that I work for has been in Oakland County, predominantly Republicans. They're very tight with their money. You know, it is what it is. I mean, rich people will be tight with their money. That's just where they are. They like to spend it on the things they like to spend it on. They don't try to give out anything extra to anybody, okay?
Okay.
When you get to the point to where you're in a position like I am, what I would be considered as the working poor, okay, and you go in, you provide a skilled trade to these white-collar professionals, you get to a spot where, you know, I've been really tossing this around in my head the last couple of years. How much money is enough money? You know, these guys are not wanting to give back anything to make this country more prosperous. The only thing it seems like they are after is more money in their pocket. Doesn't matter who they step on, doesn't matter who they walk on. You know what I mean?
Well, that's why we have ourselves in the mess that we're in. I mean, you're probably dealing with some upper middle class, maybe even some wealthy people in Oakland County. There's people in Oakland County that have enormous, that actually are the ultra wealthy. Yeah,
right.
It's almost pathological because some of these families up in the top 1%, they have wealth and income that they never could even spend, that they could never purchase stuff with, that they could more than they need to leave to their kids. So you have the Walton families that are financing with millions of dollars this idea that they want to make this inheritance tax, the one that Bush rolled back as a favor to his wealthy families, to the wealthy families that support him, to make it permanent. And again, this creates this impacted wealth that gets pushed on from generation to generation, and it's nothing. And for one thing, it's not like taking it all from the kids, because no matter where you are, you'd like to leave something for your children. But it creates these dynasties of wealth that completely destroys and erodes the idea that we could have a democratic process, because money is so impacted at the top.
Mm-hmm. You're absolutely right.
So there has to be a way to, in fact, redistribute the wealth in a way that makes sense for the entire society. So you don't have the wealthiest country in the world with all the stuff that's happening to us in this country, that things are really beginning to unravel. We're still the wealthiest country. But why then are there tens of millions of poor people? Why are there hundreds and hundreds of thousands of kids that go to bed every night at risk of hunger? Why do we have our schools so lousy? Why do we have such a high infant mortality rate? And on and on and on like that. It's because of the way that wealth is distributed. And society's come to conclusions. I mean, one of the conclusions that society's come to is that we just ought to let dog eat dog, and whoever is the toughest dog wind up with the most of it. So that's the way it was in the 19th century. So there was 100 or 150 years of struggle to get some sort of recognition for the manner in which the average person contributes to the general wealth, the common wealth that we're all part of producing. And we're going back in the other direction. So it's what I said. Either we got to revolt against this or thatch our roofs. That's it. All right, got to take a break. Thank you so much. Appreciate it, Ron. We'll be right back. Peter Werby, Jalene Jordan, 313-298-WRIF.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more of your calls right after this.
When we wanted to give you more on the riff, but we ran out of somewhere to put it all, we said, screw it. Let's make a whole nother radio station.
What's that sound?
It's music made for the Motor City and totally commercial free. Log on from anywhere in the world at riff2.com. Everything that rocks.
Hey, you can sit there and whine about things, or you can shut up and vote. Your vote is your voice. Check out shutupandvotemichigan.com to view videos of various celebrities talking about their personal reasons for voting. You can also click on the Department of Human Services logo for a voter fair near you. Hey, this stuff isn't brain surgery. This year, every vote in Michigan counts. Head to shutupandvotemichigan.com. It's Michigan's future. It's your future.
This is Matt Demmer from Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury. I'm here to tell you that we at Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury are still in the business of leasing, and we want to help you. Whether you're looking for the hot new MKS, the MKZ, or the hottest crossover vehicle, the MKX, Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury in Dearborn is your one-stop shop. At our dealership, we believe in honesty, reliability, and support for our customers just like you. You can check out our vehicle inventory on the site, and you can bet that if you don't see what you're looking for, we can surely find it for you. Experience the Demmer difference today. We're located on Michigan Avenue just east of Oakwood in Dearborn. Give us a call today. 313-274-8800. That's 313-274-8800. Or check us out on the web at Demmer.com. That's D-E-M-M-E-R.com.
Experience the Demmer difference. Right now at Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury, lease a 2009 Lincoln MKS for $379 a month. Based on an AZ plan with Ford Lincoln Mercury lease renewal and $1,969 down plus tax. See dealer for details or check them out on the web at Demmer.com.
Did you know that 1 in 5 Michigan residents is living at or below the national poverty level? That means supporting a family of four on $21,200 a year. On November 13th, at the Voices for Action Poverty Summit at Cobo Hall, Michigan will launch a statewide effort to reduce poverty and maximize economic opportunities. Join keynote speakers Martin Luther King III and Governor Jennifer Granholm for an important discussion on this statewide initiative. Log on to michigan.gov/poverty to register today. This message sponsored by the Michigan Department of Human Services.
What exactly is telemetrics and what does it mean to me?
How does changing light bulbs save me money?
Where are the best places to find organically grown foods?
When will Michigan be seeing an increase in green building?
What are some easy steps my family can take to be more green?
How can my coworkers and I start a recycling program at work?
Got lots of questions on Michigan's green future? Get lots of answers at movingmichiganforward.com. You can also join the discussion, offer your ideas, suggestions, and advice on how we can all work together to live greener in Michigan. MovingMichiganForward.com, in partnership with Next Energy, is brought to you in part by IBEW Local 58 and NECA Signatory Employers, The Good Food Company, and Charter One.
Got lots of questions on Michigan's green future? Get lots of answers at MovingMichiganForward.com.
MovingMichiganForward.com. Learn, share, grow, make your future green at MovingMichiganForward.com.
Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much. This is our last segment. 1 a.m., I have an interesting interview talking about, well, this is not very exciting, education, right? Who cares about that? We want to know, you know, is Barack Obama fill in the blank with these nutballs are calling them? I mean, who cares that our schools are crap and they're just getting worse and worse? Not all of them, just about 90% of them. You know, the rich people still got nice schools. All right, stay tuned for that. And we are taking calls from McCain supporters telling us why they are voting for McCain. Julian and I don't understand this, but we're not arguing with you. We're not going to argue with you.
I think we're both just exhausted. Yeah,
you know, my website, which, hey, if you want to get the last of the anti-Bush and anti-McCain and Palin stuff, it's Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com, PeterWerbe.com. Well, actually, if you've never been there, I think lots of interesting stuff, and I'm not bragging because I'm essentially just assembling it from other sources.
Yeah, but you spend a lot of time on that.
Sometimes.
You know.
Sometimes.
Yeah, okay. At least you admit it.
And you can see where Jalene and I are actually DJs on an HD station.
We are.
We are.
Ooh.
But we can't say any more. And if you go to the website, you'll understand why.
Yeah.
Let's see here. Where do we want to go? Oh, yeah. Here. Here's Andy in Farmington Hills. Andy, it's Peter and Jalene. Thanks for joining us on the air.
Hi, how are you doing today, guys?
Good.
Doing fine.
I'm a regular caller. I'll be brief. Basically, I work at a retail store, and I want to run a charity event. And I know I read in our, you know, in our magazine and our work that we can run, you know, pretty much, you know, run charity events for kids. And, you know, I was on the front with kids. You know, I'm a blue-collar worker, you know, and everybody thinks, oh, you live in Farmington Hills, you make all the money. No, I don't.
Okay.
And basically my point is tonight, because I'm exhausted just like you guys are. you know, worked our tails off with trucks and all that. But, you know, beside the point, I don't know, because I want to, you know, give back to my community about, you know, giving back, you know, for the holidays next year.
So you're wondering how you start a charity event?
Exactly.
Yeah. By the way, we're exhausted about the election. I'm not exhausted doing the show or anything like that.
Right. Yeah, it's about the election.
Well, I don't know what to say about how to start a charity event. I mean, you don't necessarily need any approval. I mean, you need to figure out what you want to do. I mean, is it going to be, you could have your neighbors over, and if you wanted to do it, say, for Toys for Tots or something like that, you find out, you know, you go to their website, or for Children's Leukemia Foundation, you go to their website and you learn about it, and you call, you know, 10 of your neighbors over and you say, hey, how about each of us give $10 and we'll turn it over to them. Or you get some of your neighbors or your friends and you say, let's get a band, because we know so-and-so is in a terrific band, and you ask the band to...
Are you talking about me again?
Yeah, you ask the Jalene Jordan band to perform. You're going to have 20 emails on this. And then the proceeds after the cost go to support the charity. I mean, you have to rent a place, but I mean, it takes some doing. And at first, it does seem like rocket science. But after a while, you know, if you've done it any number of times, it becomes a lot easier. But get your feet wet. I mean, community involvement is pretty good. All right, Andy, good luck on it. Let us know how it turns out. You know, I'm always mixed about that. I like it when a community gets together, and Andy has got this terrific community spirit. On the other hand, I think that why should there have to be charities? Why does, you know, that's another, by the way, charity is another redistribution of wealth.
Oh, true.
We keep
and you're
talking
saying,
about
why do we have to pick up the pieces where it should be taken care of? People shouldn't have to be struggling and need these types of things.
Yeah, I do public service announcements for one of our stations. And people are often having bowling events or any number of events for people in the community that need medical care. And I'm thinking, people have to have a bowling alley event so their so their neighbor doesn't die of cancer.
And you know what, Peter? More and more all the time.
Yeah, yeah. So, well, it's twofold. It is good that people come together as neighbors, as a community, to support someone who's less fortunate than them. But on the other hand, why should people have to be put through that? Because I think, you know, something like cancer treatment could cost tens of thousands of dollars, hundreds of thousands of dollars in some cases, and what are they going to raise? They're lucky if they're going to raise $700.
You know? That's so true.
So it barely ekes into it. Yeah, that would get a few catheters and
a Band-Aid.
A Band-Aid, given how we're being ripped in terms of our health care system. Most spent per person of any industrialized country, and we have the worst overall health care. Now,
shameful.
I have terrific health care because I have insurance.
And I
do not
have none.
So you're wondering, I don't even want to go there, why this situation is like that, which we won't, but it's not my doing. And so I'm not complaining. I don't have any health care issues. Although, you know, I pay thousands of dollars a year in copays.
I'd be happy to pay a copay.
I know you would. But think about that. If there was a universal health program, single-payer, government health care program, like there is in every other industrialized country, is that someone like myself, when I figured out, I think I pay like, you know, just we have to pay part of it. I'm not talking about when I go to a doctor, which you do anyway. But, like, there's maybe $2,500 a year. Well, I mean, I guess that goes in, that's a purchase. But, I would be spending it, what would I do? I'd go get a plasma screen.
You'd go to Cuba again.
Go to Cuba again, yeah. What did I was I thinking? I was just thinking about something about Cuba. You know, this is the 50th anniversary of their revolution.
Really?
Yeah. And someone just called me and said, why don't we go to Havana? For this will really convince people I'm a total commie. Actually, I've written articles. In fact, and I think, let me think. It's still available, on my website. The interview that Jalene did of me after I returned from a trip to Cuba.
I forgot about that.
Whereas I always worry if the government of Cuba hears it, and someone's going to send it off to them, if they hear how critical I am of the government, of the Castro government, they wouldn't let me back in. So I love
but you're
Cuba.
A member of the media, so you're allowed.
Yeah, I am.
But, well, you and I are both allowed to travel,
no,
right?
No, but I mean the Cuban government might say, you're too critical of us.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, which all I right. am.
But you go on fact-finding missions.
I do. Right. For this program. Like, mm-hmm. this is another example. Let's see. Here is Nathan in Madison Heights. Nathan, hi. It's Peter and Jalene on WRIF. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Peter. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I did 8 years in the service, United States Army. And I'll tell you what, for Mr. Obama to get on television and say that he's, you know, not going to sit down or not sit down casually with all these so-called terrorists. One in particular, Mr. Ajimadad, you know, that just kind of, you know, makes me think, I mean, what is he really going to do, you know, when he gets in office outside of the United States? I mean, I know right now, yes, our economy isn't doing so well.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, you gotta step outside the boundaries every once in a while and take a look at what he's really gonna do for, you know, the rest of the world.
Well, that's a consideration. What would you think would be the negatives about beginning negotiations with Ahmadinejad? You gotta remember the United States, this is not an argument. I mean, the United States is fighting wars on, the eastern and western borders of Iran, and the United States supported for decades one of the most horrible dictators in the world that made the current Iranian government look sweet and democratic and pleasant, that they engineered, the United States during the Reagan administration engineered a war in between Iran and Iraq that cost the lives of a million people. So they tend to be a little PO'd at the U.S., and you know, they're not anywhere in our face, Iran. So what would be the negative of the U.S. government negotiating the differences that that the United States has with Iran?
Well, I mean, I think some of the negatives. I mean, you know, I just don't want us to come away from the whole situation. I don't want to say kind of looking like softies. I mean, we're apt to another terrorist attack at any time. I mean, you know, I think our borders are souped up, and after 9/11, we did kind of take heed and kind of put the precaution signs up. But you know, I think if Barack, you know, gets elected and gets put in the office, I think, you know, he's just going to kind of go the way of, hey, you know what, let's all just sit down, let's talk about things, let's not, you know, not be aggressive.
Wait, that doesn't sound like a good idea. I mean, we've been aggressive. the United States has been aggressive. We've
invaded countries,
occupied them, drained our treasury, gone into debt. I don't know how much more aggressive, and it's just put us in a terrible situation. You know, by negotiating with people doesn't mean that you're going to give in. You know, you could say, what are our different, you know, I would think the United States would do well to negotiate with every single country in the world with which it has differences. And maybe these could be resolved, because a lot of it is, I mean, one first thing the Iranians might ask us is, what the hell are you doing in the Middle East in the first place, right?
Oh, exactly.
Yeah, so I don't think Barack Obama would do this, but I wish he would. He might say, we're leaving. We're out of here. We've been mucking around in the affairs of this region because we've been trying to control oil. For generations, we've caused so much damage to your part of the world and also to our country, and we're doing it just for oil, and we're going to stop that. All right, thank you very much. Appreciate it, Nathan, although I guess I was arguing with him, wasn't I?
Peter, you broke the rule.
I did.
And I let you as your producer, bad producer.
I did, yeah. Here's Geraldo in Detroit. Geraldo, hi, you're on the air.
Hello, hey, how are you guys doing?
Oh, fine.
That sounded exciting.
No, ready for this to be over with.
Well, you know what? It's like Obama was speaking about, you know, like being at war with Iraq and what have you. But people have been speaking about redistribution of the wealth. From what Obama's been saying, he's going to redistribute our military to Iran, because, I mean, I do believe as well.
Geraldo, what the hell are you talking about? Redistribute our
wealth to Iran?
Yeah, what are you talking
military.
About?
Military.
No, he's not. Oh. No, he's not. He's never said that. He's never. I don't know how you can use that phrase, but redistribute our military to Iran. But he's not talking about. Please tell me or show me or quote to me where that's happened. It's never happened.
Yeah, he has. He said it during several debates.
He said that he was going to what? Use another word other than redistribute, because that usually has to do with wealth. You say he's going to invade Iran?
Well, you know what? During Democratic debates, somebody challenged him on being soft on defense, and he vehemently said maybe about five times or so, I will go to war with Iran. And he shouted it out in the crowd.
You know, Geraldo.
I watched all of them.
He never said that. You're just repeating nonsense. You're repeating something that never occurred. I'm not very happy with the positions of Barack Obama, either on Iraq or on Afghanistan. But he never, ever said anything like that, and the crowd never cheered. All right, goodbye.
And no more arguing, Peter.
You're talking nonsense. Yeah. All right. Here is John in Highland. John, hi. It's Peter and Jolene. You're on the air.
Hi. How's it going?
Good.
Just real quick. 22. This would be my first time voting. The only problem is, you know, we're right around the corner with the whole entire election thing, and I really don't feel like I'm that informed. Mm-hmm. I just feel like, from each side of the parties, I guess you could say, all I hear is like slanderous remarks and garbage coming from each side. And when I watched
the debates,
welcome to politics.
Yeah, well, yeah. I think he hung up.
Yeah, well, I think he lost his train of thought. It's easy to do when you
one of the things you do
in.
When you've been doing this for a long time, like I do, I often lose my train of thought, but you know how to fake it. So, all right, it's like
Sarah Palin style. Just change the subject.
Yeah, right. let's see. Here's Travis and Warren. Travis, how are you on the air?
Hello, how are you doing?
Yeah. Good, good.
I'd like to say the only reason why I wouldn't vote for Barack Obama is because I would never vote for a president who couldn't sit down and have bacon and eggs with me.
What makes you think he wouldn't have bacon and eggs with you? Are you kidding?
Am I kidding?
Yeah.
He has a Muslim name. He's running for president. Have I ever seen him sit down and eat pork?
Travis, I can't. When's the next bus leaving for another planet? Oh. Man? One of us ought to get on it, Travis.
I can't go on.
How could people be this dumb?
My God.
I mean, he must have been joking. Let's, yeah.
No, I don't think he was, Peter. You're giving him the benefit of the doubt.
Well, Travis, let me give you some. Let me give you some
Listen,
advice.
Listen, Trav.
If you repeat this, people are going to think you're really stupid. Yeah. So don't say that to anybody else. Yes, just keep it down. It's between you and me and Jolene. No one else heard.
And the million people who are listening.
Yeah, that's right. Here's Larry in Vancouver. Is this like Vancouver, British Columbia?
Yes. I haven't phoned for a while, but I've been listening to you. And I just want to say you guys have a good show still, and you have also a very good website as well.
Well, thank you, Larry.
Thank you.
And I just want to make 2 points. There's a lot of banding around about the word socialism.
Mm-hmm.
But I noticed that McCain and Palin never mentioned about the bailouts of Wall Street.
Yeah, that's big socialism.
And, you know, in London they call that nationalization, but they're not mentioning about that.
You know that Hugo Chavez from Venezuela, he said, welcome, Comrade Bush. He said, you're finally coming around to socialist programs. But it's socialism for the rich, right?
Yes, yes. It's a redistribution up.
Yeah, that's right. That's another redistribution. They're taking $750 billion of our money that we sweated for, and they're giving it over to these rich guys who made these catastrophic mistakes based on greed. And so why doesn't anybody see that as I think a lot of people do. But Barack Obama says, I want to return the tax structure to what it was in 1998, 10 years ago. And they buy into this stupidity mouthed by McCain and Palin that somehow that's redistribution of income. Well, I mean, technically speaking, it is. You know, Palin says they want to raise tax, or Barack Obama wants to raise taxes on people. Well, in fact, those that are making over $250,000 a year are people. So she's technically correct, but 90% of the people in the United States that pay taxes are actually going to pay less tax.
Well, it's all distortion and smokescreen.
It is.
Yeah.
But, the second point I wanted to make was that the Republicans have been bringing up out about how Obama's piled around with this one, how Obama's piled around with this one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But according to PBS Frontline, I think the program was called The Choice, when Obama was at Harvard Law School,
yeah,
doing the Harvard Law Review, they didn't seem to mention that when he was there, he also piled around with a lot of conservative law students.
Uh-oh.
And but they haven't mentioned that.
No. Well, everything, you know what I think Obama ought have had ads that said, I'm rubber, you're glue. Everything you say about me bounces off me and sticks on you. Because actually
that's really how ridiculous it is.
Well,
isn't it?
But on the other hand, it's true, is that McCain has palled around with terrorists more, Barack Obama never palled around with anybody who was functioning as a terrorist at the given time. There's numerous cases where McCain was during the Iran-Contra stuff. His connection with people in the the World Anti-Communist League. Palin is all hooked up with these far right-wing militarists the Alaska Independence Party.
Right.
So if anybody is connected with actual functioning terrorists, it certainly isn't Barack Obama. It's McCain and Palin and everything else that they mentioned. There's 10 times more on their side than there is on Barack Obama's side. Hey, you know what I got to do? I got to get a couple more calls in here, Larry. Thanks for calling all the way from Vancouver and making our show international. I appreciate it, but I'm almost out of time. I want to get a couple more people in here. Here's Brian in Sterling Heights. Brian, hi, it's Peter and Jolene. You're on the air.
How you doing? This is my first time calling.
Welcome.
Yeah, I'm a little nervous. Sorry. There's somebody talking about gay marriage and how it's not natural. I took psychology last semester at Macomb Community College. My teacher was talking about genetics, and he says with genetics, all genetics have patterns, and there's just genetics that, you know, determine your sexuality. And he said if there's patterns for blue eyes and hair and all that stuff, there could also be genetics for, you know, your sexuality. And why would people have to not believe that, you know, it's not based on genetics and it's based on society? I don't get it.
Yeah, well, and then, which makes it natural.
Yes. Right.
Right. And, I mean, there must be, why would there be this tendency towards homosexual activity in most societies, and so the fact that it's has a universal appearance in you know, human sexuality. So there's got, I mean, anyways, what if it's not, quote, natural? Like I say, it's not natural for people to fly in airplanes. It's not natural for people to drive in cars. Or
the list goes on and on.
Yeah, yeah. So natural, what the hell is that?
Hey, Peter, we got it.
People.
Yeah.
Still people.
All right, Brian, thank you for that.
Thank
appreciate
you.
It.
We got an email. Julene is being bad tonight. I think she's pissed off at something. So I said, you think?
Yeah.
I'm bad every day. Come
yes,
on.
Tries to do it. Let's see here. Where is... okay, here's Maurice in Detroit. Maurice, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, hello, Julene. Hello, Peter. Hello, Peter and Julene.
Hi, Maurice!
You know, I just want to say this, you know. I give McCain credit that he served 5 years in prison in Vietnam.
Yeah.
You ever think when he was in POW camp, he could have been brainwashed like the Manchurian candidate? We don't know what this dude, what was done to him.
Yeah.
And he old.
Yeah, he is.
Oh, Sharon, I see her in a basketball uniform. In high school, she had a hot body on her. But Barack Obama, I tell you, made my mind up on him.
He is old. You're right.
There's a lot of world leaders his age, though. All right, Maurice, thanks for that.
I'm more worried about his melanoma coming back.
Yeah, well.
And
yeah.
That crazy.
Yeah.
SP.
Indeed. Oh, that's not a disease. That's Sarah Palin.
Yeah.
Right.
One could argue.
Okay. We'll go out on this
and
note.
Mental illness.
Here's Jeff from Plymouth. Jeff, hi. You're on the air.
Good morning. I am supporting John McCain. And one of the biggest, one of the largest reasons why is the fact that I think have the Democratic Party running all three, the House and the Senate and the presidency, I think would be bad for our country.
That'd be a horrible situation. Oh, yeah, that's what happened under the Republicans, didn't
Ooh.
It?
Well, we did have a Democratic House and Democrat. Obviously, we have Pelosi and we have Reid.
Wait, for 2 years. For six years, they had a lock on it. And they kind of screwed everything up, didn't they? Okay, I mean, that is an argument that I've heard. And so you could have total gridlock. You could have an overwhelmingly Democratic Congress and a Republican president. I don't know. Give the guy a shot, I'd say. But thank you, Jeff. Thanks for being our last caller. Sorry to leave some of you on hold, but we've got to say...
good night.
Good night and good luck.
Good luck. Don't get frustrated in the lines.
Yeah, yeah.
Take a snack.
Yeah, it's going to be a beautiful...
And a deep breath.
And it's supposed to be a beautiful day on Tuesday.
On Tuesday.
As well. And hopefully this will be one of the last Tuesdays we'll ever vote on. That there's more and more talk about having it
on the weekend.
Yeah, but I think we need a national holiday. We want another day off. They say, oh, it's going to cost billions of dollars. Hey, come on. Workers of the world, relax.
Yes.
All right. We'll talk to you next week.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call right after this.
This is Richard Marusek.
And his lovable brother, Carl.
Of Ace Diamond Jewelers. As jewelers, we want to apologize for how confusing buying a diamond has become.
When you scrape away all the BS, we're talking about polished rocks dug out of the ground. And there are only two things that matter.
Will she love it? And can you afford it?
First, let's consider her reaction. How's a jeweler more qualified than you to determine her taste? You don't need four C's. You've got two I's.
And when it comes to price, everybody claims to be a wholesaler. Either they have an uncle in the city who was married to a woman whose cousin knows this guy, who has a brother with a connection, or they flew to South Africa and dug the stones out of the ground themselves. They've even got calluses to prove it.
Believe what you want, but here at Ace, we ain't playing. We just bring in diamonds and wedding sets of high quality, price them fairly, and let you decide for yourself. And just for the record, I am a wholesaler.
He's even got the calluses to prove it.
Hey!
Ace Diamond Jewelers at 13840 Michigan Avenue in Dearborn, right across from City Hall.
Ace, helping couples copulate since 1978.
That's it. I'm out of here.
You hear stories about people just putting their keys on the counter and walking away. Trouble is, even if the bank does sell your house, you still may be liable for the difference between the sale price and what you owe. That's right. You've lost your home, tanked your credit rating, and you may still have to pay the difference. That's where I come in. This is Mike Greiner from the Financial Law Group. As a former deputy mayor of Warren, I've seen how the depressed economy affects people's lives and livelihood. Before you call one of those 800 numbers, call me. I'll help you file for bankruptcy and get out from under your credit card debt. If you're in danger of losing your home, let's talk about your options. It's my job to help you resolve your legal issues in the simplest, most cost-effective way possible.
The Financial Law Group, 586-693-2000. Evening and weekend appointments available. Call 586-693-2000. The Financial Law Group, using the law to protect your financial future.
The Financial Law Group is a debt relief agency helping people file for bankruptcy relief under the bankruptcy laws.
We're HD Radio and we approve this message.
They want you to keep the same rinky-dink alarm clock radio and backyard boombox you've had for 20 years. We want every American to have a new radio with crystal clear sound and more stations to choose from. They like to cut in front of veterans at the supermarket. Make the right choice, America. Ask for HD Radio.
Get a new HD Radio at TargetandCrutchfield.com and visit HDRadio.com. It's time to upgrade.
All too often, people believe they have to work long, hard hours to buy their loved ones the gifts they desire. That's why Caesars Windsor created the Play for Presents promotion. Play every Sunday from October 19th to November 16th and earn up to 7 times your base reward credits for items like designer jewelry or a plasma TV. 5 special Sundays, 7 times closer to the perfect gift.
Must be 19 years of age or older to participate. Official rules available at the Total Reward Center.
101 WRIF celebrates the return of AC/DC to the Motor City with your AC/DC Perfect Playlist. Submit your AC/DC Perfect Playlist right now at WRIF.com. Then, this Wednesday from 11 a.m. until showtime, we'll be playing them back for you. Everyone whose list gets played will be in the running to win a pair of front row tickets to AC/DC's sold-out show that night. Plus, catch the chance and replay on 101 WRIF Wednesday night right after the sold-out show.
Hello, this is Brian Johnson of AC/DC, and you're listening to Detroit's home of rock and roll, WRIF.
The Riff. 101 WRIF
in WRIF HD1 Detroit.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. Well, a couple of days, big election's going to be here, and all the issues have been aired, some more fully than others, some on a more intellectual and policy basis than others, but we get what we get. One issue that I have not heard very much about, and even though I don't have any children, is of great concern to me. That's our education system. And I don't know, I mean, I know most of you are in the Detroit area, so I can say this, I think, with the count around Detroit, and certainly Detroit itself, most of the educational systems, the schools, aren't in the shape that most parents and most citizens would like. Well, this is certainly a problem that is recognized by many, and there's many solutions. But I came across a book I thought that deserved some air time. And joining me is Carl Glickman. He's the editor of a book called Those Who Dared. It's 5 visionaries who changed American education. And Carl Glickman is president of the Institute for Schools, Education, and Democracy. He's also the co-convener of the Forum for Education and Democracy. He's the editor of Letters to the Next President, What He Can Do About the Real Crisis in Public Education, and it's the 2008 election edition. It's published by the Teachers College Press, and Carl Glickman joins us by telephone from the home of the B-52s and REM. That's Athens, Georgia. Carl Glickman, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Well, thank you very much, Peter. It's a real pleasure to be there, or be here in talking to you there.
Well, you know, if there hasn't been, speaking about talking, there hasn't been much talk about education in this election run-up, has there?
That's true. That's true. And it's, well, it's not surprising because of the war and the economy that education at that point, when people looking at their own finances and shelter and security, that education wouldn't be one of the top priorities. But it's unfortunate because education, particularly public education, really is the DNA of a democracy. And as Jefferson wrote long time ago, that there is no democracy without an educated citizenry.
Are we becoming less educated? I know I get worried when I think that the generation below me doesn't have the education and educational and intellectual skills that my generation did, and I know the generation before me thought that about us.
Oh, exactly.
So are we dumbing down, or is it just the way older people always look at youth?
I think it's an issue of where the priorities have been put on education today. Is that education is primarily viewed now as something to advance a student's own career or future learning, or it's seen as helping develop the workers of tomorrow. And the public purpose of education really has been ignored. And as a result of it, we don't have the breadth or the richness in learning or in curriculum that we may have had in past generations. And this particularly affects schools where there's high poverty.
Well, there's been a lot of criticisms of modern education, and part of it lies in funding. But in terms of curriculum, there has been this this trend of saying, why are we bothering to read these old dead white men? And that this classic education that conservatives, intellectual conservatives, want to instill with so much of the classics has kind of gone by the wayside. And I think if you tried to pull some of the classics that, say, our grandfather's generation read, they wouldn't be well received by young people.
Well, actually, I think the reverse is true, to tell you the truth, is I agree in terms of the classics, is that that only in schools and communities where there's fairly high wealth and students are expected to do as well as their professional parents, you'll find curriculum that's similar to past generations. And also you'll see some additional ways that students learn through the internet and through experiences outside the school. But what's happened in the United States is it's been a search for finding a single bullet or answer to how to improve education in primarily in poor communities. I think if you ask most parents who are in the suburbs, and have a fairly high wealth base, do their students know as much as they did when they were in the same grade level? Most parents would say, actually, my children's curriculum is tougher than it was when I went to school. And when I have to explain math or algebra or help them with their homework, it's really not the work that I had at that age. So what's contradictory in a sense is we seem to blanket all education as falling apart. And the truth is most parents judge their own public school where their child goes to as doing quite well. But where we have a real concentration of poverty in large cities like Detroit or Milwaukee or Chicago, education has been reduced more and more to simply preparing kids to pass a test, which has been legislated upon all these schools in America. And obviously, if you're a struggling student, you don't have the kind of experiences outside of school of going to museums or libraries or concerts or summer camp, et cetera, and school to you becomes preparation for a test, it weakens. It actually creates more resistance and apathy among students, and that's why we have the kind of dropout rate that we are experiencing in primarily low-income communities.
Mm-hmm. Carl Glickman is my guest. He's the editor of Those Who Dared, Five Visionaries Who Changed American Education. We'll get to their visions in just a little while. Well, I think, like everything in this country, as you drop down from the highest level, things correspondingly in everything from education and healthcare and city services and roads, the farther you fall down the social economic scale, the worse things get. So, sure, if you go to the wealthy areas surrounding Detroit, they're pretty good, and the schools are good, and the parents don't have too many complaints. If you go into Detroit, into the inner cities, every parent has a complaint about how that there's the equipment's not good, the schools are falling apart, there's too many kids in the class. But as you start to get into the lower middle class suburbs and the working class suburbs, parents also have some of those same complaints that Detroit parents have. They're also underfunded and understaffed, and the equipment is not what we would think. I mean, I increasingly get kids in my suburban neighborhood coming around and having they're selling stuff so they can get volleyballs or so they can take a trip or
right.
Well, trip, maybe that's something different, but things they're raising funds for things that you would think would be part of what the school would provide.
That's true. That's true. And I guess when I was talking about low income and in poverty, I was talking about both the middle class and lower socioeconomic class, is that resources are very uneven today. And with the way finances and the budgets are most recently, that unevenness is probably going to be accentuated even further. And I think part of the reason is that we don't see public education as an education for the public anymore. We tend to think public education are the schools that students go to that we pay taxes for, but we really don't see those schools as belonging to us unless we have our own children or grandchildren there. And 90% of all children in the United States go to public schools. And the origins of public schools was to provide an education for the public so people could think for themselves, that they could use their education to raise questions, to solve problems, to be productive and valuable citizens of a larger society. And so I think the reason we have the inequity in resources today is that most people don't view public schools unless they're connected themselves with their own children as belonging to us. And that's why right now there has not been a grand support or of a lot of attention by the public at large in terms of public schools. And it's an unfortunate state of being, because if we actually understand that the education that every child receives in America has a direct result to what this society, what this democratic society is going to be able to do in the future, is absolutely critical. I mean, these are our neighbors, these are our workers, these are our problem solvers, or we go the other way, or we create, if we don't provide the kind of education that equips students for the future, then these become people who become a drag on themselves and a drag on their own communities and a drag on society at large.
Carl Glickman, I want to just go a little bit more in general, and then I want to get to the five visionaries who changed American education, who are the subject of your book, Those Who Dared. By the way, you can go to tcpress.com. It's Teachers College Press, tcpress.com. There's a link to Carl Glickman's book, and there'll be a link on my website as well, peterwerby.com. But you mentioned about standardized testing, and that's through the No Child Left Behind Act. And what it seems that there should be standards. Why isn't the standardized tests with No Child Left Behind adequate for the task or doing what its framers would like?
The details are probably too much, but the basic idea of No Child Left Behind was to see that all students achieve well and that we start to eliminate the huge gaps we have in learning among students by ethnicity, race, by gender, by special needs, by second language. And so the actual, the act itself, the preamble to the act is really quite wonderful. The problem comes in how the act, what the rules and procedures and the implementation of the act, is that what occurred is instead of measuring a full range of how students learn, the only measures that count now are measures that are on standardized tests that students take towards the end of the school year in certain core subjects in reading and math. And what it does is it then gives a number for every student, and then according to a pretty complicated formula, it then says whether or not the school has adequately performed and if enough students have reached the mastery levels. The problem with the implementation is that the test publishers themselves say that their own tests should never be used as the sole measure of what a student has learned. Now, these aren't the critics of the test. These are the test makers. And also, what has happened over the years now, since No Child Left Behind has been enacted, which is many years at this point, is what we're finding in the schools that have the most kids who are at risk of failing, we find the most restrictive, narrow, passive, boring, repetitive curriculum taught to the kids that just align directly with the test that they need to meet. And so the result of it is that our children aren't learning in ways that would equip them to live in the outside world. I mean, what they're learning is they're learning how to be passive, how they're learning how to do lots of homework and preparation for these tests, even when we know the tests are inadequate to fully measuring what a student learns. So without going into great detail, if Peter, you started this out with the town that I'm from, which is Athens, Georgia, where REM and some musical groups have come out of this town. Musicians become greater experts through their performance, not just their practicing over and over again, but the fact that they play live and they get feedback from an audience. Our best football players and our best football player teams, they are not as skillful if they didn't play on Friday night or Saturday morning. It's not the practice by itself that equips someone to learn something deeply. It's the performance of that practice. And what we have done in schools, primarily schools that have a lot of children who are struggling, is we've reduced this curriculum so everything is practice, 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 and students never get to perform reading. They don't get to read a book and answer questions about it and be assessed by what they understand about actually reading. Reading instead is said to be what you scored on a particular reading test. So we can go through the whole thing. Does one really know math until you actually use math in ways in the real world? Your chemistry, your physics, your science, we become proficient in how we have to demonstrate what we've learned that goes beyond a single test. So the result is now is in our most struggling schools, we have a curriculum that is totally narrow, that has no interest to students or to teachers, for that matter, but they have to focus on it. And it reduces schools to just basically being places of drill.
Well, not very inviting. I found school pretty boring. This sounds even worse.
It is even worse. Because when you and I went to school, I don't know your age, but I don't know, probably we're within 20 years of each other, is school most of the time was pretty boring. But we did have some teachers that inspired us.
We did.
We had some teachers who taught us that what we were learning was not just something that would be good to get your assignment complete, but it actually had some relevance to a larger life outside of school. So, and those are the teachers we remember. And what's happened is we have less and less of these teachers because teachers today are so restricted in what they can teach and how they can teach and what time they need to do page 13 and before I go to page 14.
Yeah. Well, Carl Glickman, let's look at some of the five visionaries who changed American education. It's the subtitle of your book, Those Who Dared. And I don't know if this is the correct way to go about it. You tell me, because I live in an area that right next to two educational districts, school districts. And one it was previously a one that sent the most kids to college, and this was like in the 50s and the 60s and some into the 70s. And then it became more and more of a poorer suburb, and it literally went down the drain in terms of performance, people going to college. It became crime-ridden, violent. And everyone gnashed their teeth, but little or nothing was done. Do the five visionaries who changed American education? Is there any look at that kind of situation?
Well, most of these people, these five who I have in the book, where they have written their stories of what they struggled through in trying to change public schools, most of their work has concentrated in urban areas or in towns that have had changing demographics. I mean, not exclusively. I mean, some like Ted Sizer, who had been the dean at Harvard and then headmaster at Andover Academy, who later said, well, look, if this is what we do at Andover Academy, where we educate students in a certain way to think for themselves, then why shouldn't we be doing this throughout our whole public education system? And that's where he then devoted the last 20-plus years of his life to working with secondary schools. So the question is, yes, Jim Comer, who is a good example of this, Jim Comer, African-American, grew up in an African-American community. When he was ready to go to high school, he had three other friends who were just as smart, just as talented as he was, but he knew that the day before he left the college and he said goodbye to his friends, there was tears in his eyes because he said he knew when he came back that they would be going downhill while he was going uphill. And so he became a medical doctor, and then he has devoted his whole life to working in communities that understand that education doesn't just happen within the school walls. It also happens outside of the school walls, and has to do with the quality of life and whether or not a student has a toothache and therefore hasn't slept the night before and therefore cannot pay attention to what's going on that early morning class, or if students have a very unsettled family life, or if students are concerned about their own safety and danger, that what he learned in always having this image of his friends who didn't make it, he always had this image they could have made it. They could have made it if they had had the type of challenge and support that he had growing up as a youngster, which is he did get health and he did get dental treatments and he did have opportunities to visit places where his parents were concerned about, his community was concerned about, that there's other worlds out here, and that education is in some sense exploring these other worlds. So James Comer has developed thousands of schools in very challenging situations where they bring the community and the school together, and they provide resources and they provide education both to parents and to family and the students. And then they also arrange outside of school experiences. And so he really thinks about education as a community endeavor, not simply the school by itself. And he's had great success. Probably over 1,000 schools have been part of the Comer model. But again, it's a way that more schools are trying to go. But the accepted assumptions are that you send your kid to school, the teachers close the door, and then you don't have to be too concerned as a community until those doors open back up at the end of the school day.
Well, you sort of answered my question. I was going to say that as long as you have these divergence in wealth of very poor communities in our country and very wealthy ones, that when you go to any poor community anywhere in the world, doesn't matter color, country, religion, whatever, that the poor exhibit these qualities that we're concerned about. And it is more a definition of poverty than anything else. And you know what I'm getting at?
Yes, I do know what you're getting at. And I think what the outliers help to explain why there are schools in high poverty places that do extraordinarily well, and what are the conditions that surround them? And that's what Comer did. I mean, Comer actually worked in New Haven. He worked in large urban school areas, and what they tried to do is show that you can educate poor students extremely well if you look at their education as not solely what's in the school, but the coordination of resources within the community with the school. And so I think the big issue we have today, even with the presidential campaigns that are going on right now, is that to address poverty by itself is a daunting task.
Sure.
To address the quality of education within a school is a daunting task. And what Comer has said is, and I think you see this in the presidential campaign, is, you know, federal government can't do it all by itself. States can't do it all by itself. You got to have local communities. I mean, local communities that have employers, that have social agencies, that have cultural institutions. They need to be brought in with the school itself in deciding and in prioritizing what kinds of programs do we need to provide, not only for the student, but from the families at large, so that students can see that their education goes on in school and outside of school, and that it is something that my education eventually can help strengthen my own family, my own community, and it can give us opportunities we haven't had before. So Obama, for example, I think he knows this pretty well from his experiences in Chicago. So he says, like, well, what the federal government can do is we can be an incentive. We can help schools and districts go that way by providing sort of incentive grants to states to help bring community agencies and schools together. The way that John McCain's campaign has been is to look at schools more as more in terms of opening them up to privatization and to the free market, where you create competition among schools and then you let parents choose where they might go. But the issue is we can never rest in a democracy which has this concept of equality with the idea that education makes someone free, that if you don't have an education, then you can't be a free-thinking person. So therefore, we do have an obligation to have educated citizens to promote a better problem-solving, forward-looking democracy itself.
Mm-hmm. Well, we are out of time, unfortunately.
We're out of time already. Oh.
Well, time flies regardless. But Carl Glickman has been my guest. The book is Those Who Dared, Five Visionaries Who Changed American Education. It'll be available. It's a thin volume, but it's got five very potent suggestions on how we could improve American education. It's published by Teachers College Press. You can go to tcpress.com or my website, peterwerby.com. Donna Shalala, who was the former U.S. Secretary of Health and Human Services, says, during the last half century, five heroes changed how we think about, lead, study, and organize American education. Their stories are powerful reminders that individuals can make a difference. Carl Glickman, thanks for being on the Peter Werby Show.
Well, thank you very much, Peter.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this.
Hey guys, is your sex life really as good as it could be? Or are you missing out because your performance in the bedroom is less than great? If you suffer from lack of sexual confidence and want to feel better about yourself and your sex life, then you need to try Zencore Plus. Zencore is the powerful natural male enhancement product available today. Zencore works fast and will keep you going strong all night long. You'll have an amazing renewal of self-confidence and energy that people will notice, especially when it counts most in the bedroom. Just take Zencore 45 minutes before sexual activity and you're ready to go. First time, every time, guaranteed. So be the man and get your free supply of Zencore Plus right now. Once you do, you'll be a customer for a long time.
Find out how you can get your free supply of Zencore before it's too late. Call 1-800-431-1481. That's 1-800-431-1481. Size does matter. Don't miss out on your free supply. 1-800-431-1481. That's 1-800-431-1481.
How do you like to take a break with a Kit Kat bar and a coffee? And how'd you like to sing the Kit Kat jingle to thousands of people? But what if you could sing the Kit Kat jingle off-key and no one would laugh at you? And what if you could call into 101 WRIF to win an MP3 player? Then keep listening to The Riff for your chance to call in and win a new MP3 player. Stop by your favorite convenience store and pick up a Kit Kat bar with your coffee today.
What was that?
Oh, that? It's the sound of Motor City Seals and Deals, cutting prices on gift certificates to great Metro Detroit businesses.
I gotta see this.
The website is MotorCitySealsAndDeals.com. They always have great deals, and every Monday they launch new ways to save. You can't beat it.
Have replacement automobile keys made by Aaron's Lock and Key. Get schooled at the Paul Green School of Rock. Save on fine jewelry at the Showroom of Elegance, or catch your favorite games at Art and Jake's. Start saving at half price or more.
Sign up for Motor City Steals and Deals email updates at WRIF.com.
Hello, this is Attorney D. Todd Williams. Being charged with a crime is one of the most significant and stressful moments of one's life. From misdemeanors to serious felonies to...
$9 million.
To all of you who have stuck with me.
Divided by 900,000 citizens.
Through very difficult times.
$10 a head. Now, you're not getting much more out of these guys.
I'm sorry.
Good thing you can still text message us at the RIF. Get your request, concert info, and your unfair cellular advantage. Text keyword WRIF to 71913. And,
I'm sorry.
We'll never be embarrassed to hear from you.
I would never quit on you.
Log on to WRIF.com for more details. 101 WRIF.
My phone blowing up.
Hey, you can sit there and whine about things, or you can shut up and vote. Your vote is your voice. Check out shutupandvotemichigan.com to view videos of various celebrities talking about their personal reasons for voting. You can also click on the Department of Human Services logo for a voter fair near you. Hey, this stuff isn't brain surgery. This year, every vote in Michigan counts. Head to shutupandvotemichigan.com. It's Michigan's future. It's your future.
This is Matt Demmer from Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury. I'm here to tell you that we at Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury are still in the business of leasing, and we want to help you. Whether you're looking for the hot new MKS, the MKZ, or the hottest crossover vehicle, the MKX, Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury in Dearborn is your one-stop shop. At our dealership, we believe in honesty, reliability, and support for our customers just like you. You can check out our vehicle inventory on the site, and you can bet that if you don't see what you're looking for, we can surely find it for you. Experience the Demmer difference today. We're located on Michigan Avenue just east of Oakwood in Dearborn. Give us a call today, 313-274-8800. That's 313-274-8800. Or check us out on the web at Demmer.com. That's DEMMER.com.
Experience the Demmer difference. Right now at Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury, lease a 2009 Lincoln MKS for $379 a month. Based on an AZ plan with Ford Lincoln Mercury lease renewal and $1,969 down plus tax. See dealer for details or check them out on the web at Demmer.com.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. It's a pleasure to be with you. I think all of you have heard terms like middle class and working class. Some of you have even heard of like elite class and ruling class. But how many of you ever heard of the missing class? The missing class is the near poor in America. And the book I'm holding in my hand is called The Missing Class, Portraits of the Near Poor in America. And the authors are Catherine S. Newman and Victor Tan Shen, with a foreword by Senator John Edwards. Joining me from New York City is Catherine Newman. And Catherine Newman is the author of 8 previous books. She's the Forbes Class of 41 Professor of Sociology and Public Affairs at Princeton University. She's appeared on CNN, Oprah, NBC, CBS, and NPR, and now The Peter Werby Show. Catherine Newman, joining me from New York, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Yeah, there has been all of a sudden, this is, I'm trying to think how many years of, 50 years ago almost it was, where we discovered that there was poor in the United States, the other America, the famous Michael Harrington book, and we hear a lot about the poor, but tell us who the missing class is, the near poor. That's not usually a phrase we hear too frequently.
No, I don't think it's a phrase that's ever been used before. It denotes the people in our country who are between 100 and 200% of the poverty line. So they are above the poverty line, but they are hardly safe, and we certainly wouldn't call them middle class. So they range from $20,000 to $40,000 a year for a family of four. And I call them the missing class because they have never been labeled, tracked, or really paid much attention to at all. Even so, there are 54 million Americans who fall into this category, and I think they deserve some attention.
Catherine Newman, tell us a little about the numbers here, because when you read the poverty statistic, let's go to the class below the missing class that you write about in your new book, and sometimes when I look at what they expect a family to afford to live on, like 18 to 20,000, almost everyone knows that's not possible, including those people at that level. So if you make 21,000, allegedly, you're not poor anymore. But I would suspect that probably middle-class people at least would find the poverty category is almost impossible to live on, and the near poor would maybe expand even another 100%. You think that's possible?
I think you're absolutely right that living below the poverty line means extraordinary hardship in a country of great wealth. And so most of us would find it very difficult to struggle on the income that's below the poverty line. The people who appear in the missing class are better off than that, but they're not safe. In fact, ironically, because they're better off, they are often excluded from some of the benefit programs that make it possible, though not easy, to survive below the poverty line. So if you are in the missing class, if you are near poor, you don't qualify anymore for things like Medicaid. You're cut out of some of the food stamp programs and other programs that help in a modest way to cushion the blows of extreme poverty. And so the missing class is missing in every respect, missing from the support programs we provide for those who are very poor, but they also tend not to be in jobs that provide health insurance, for example. And their earnings are still pretty meager. I mean, as you get up to the top, up to $40,000, now you're talking about something that is, you know, more survivable. At $21,000, you're pretty close to the poverty line. And it is indeed a difficult struggle.
Mm-hmm. And is there, when in the subtitle of your book, The Missing Class, is Portraits of the Near Poor in America, is there a single portrait, or is it a mixed group, in urban and rural and white and black and Hispanic?
It is a mixed group. The people I studied most carefully are inner-city minorities here in New York. They are Dominicans, Puerto Ricans, African Americans, living in neighborhoods that are not the classic high-poverty neighborhood, but instead often living in neighborhoods that have been on the receiving end of gentrification. And that can be good news and bad news. The good news is that if they've been able to hold on to their housing in those neighborhoods, they are probably living in safer spaces than they've ever lived before, with more police paying attention, with more stores on the block, probably more order in the streets. But many people will no longer be there in this class because gentrification means rents are rising and landlords have figured out they can replace these folks with more well-heeled types. So they don't live in the sort of isolated high-poverty neighborhood. They live in this much more limbo sort of neighborhood that can go either way, plus or minus, for their families. They are often working more than one job in order to stay where they are. So I think, for example, of one man that I got to know fairly well who works during the week in a facility for people who have mental health issues and on the weekend in a hospital. So he more or less works 7 days a week. I think of mothers who are working in factories in New Jersey and commuting out from New York and whose husbands or partners have informal off-the-books jobs. And only when you have these two income streams at the same time do you pull into the missing class as opposed to the below the poverty line.
Well, are you with me?
Pardon me?
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought I lost you there for a second.
No, I'm here.
That's good. Catherine Newman is my guest. She's the co-author with Victor Tanshen of The Missing Class, Portraits of the Near Poor in America. It is published by Beacon Press. You can go to beacon.org, and it'll be on my website as well. Now, you're a professor of sociology, and sociologists are supposed to kind of coldly and calculatedly look at social phenomena. But I suspect, as I've talked to people that have done work like this in the past, that there's also an aspect of compassion on the person viewing this. So is this scene we look at, the missing class, is it disturbing to you on both a personal and a professional level?
Well, it is a more mixed picture than would be the case in many of the books I've written about poverty. Those who are below the poverty line really do represent a pretty dire situation. The missing class does provide some space for optimism, I think, because many of these families have really worked themselves to a frenzy to try and pull themselves above the poverty line, and they have, in good economic times, succeeded in doing that. So the dilemma in this book is not so much about extreme deprivation as it is the question of whether their achievements will be sustained. Sustained in their own lifetime, sustained across the generations. Will their children follow in their footsteps, or will they sink below the poverty line? And that, I think, is a very serious question, because when parents are working as many hours as these people do to stay above the poverty line, the rub comes somewhere, and it principally comes in the form of the limited time they have with their children. And so young children find themselves often with problems in school because their parents really don't have the time and attention span to take care of them in the way that middle-class families do. They're just working every hour around the clock. And older children are vulnerable to criminal justice problems and dropping out of school, again, you know, because their parents are really very stressed trying to provide for them. So there is actually reason, I think, for optimism in the sense that the parents are doing better and they're happy that they've been able to earn more and they feel better than they did when they were really poor, but the next generation may replicate their life experience rather than be able to build on top of it.
Yeah, well, that's unusual, because I was going to say some of what you were describing is a classic immigrant experience going back and, well, even to the 1830s and 1840s, certainly into that wave between 1880 and 1920, where people came over, and you were mentioning a number of immigrant groups and who you studied for your book, The Missing Class, and it was the same thing. The kids were running on the street, the parents were working in sweatshops on the Lower East Side in your city, and yet there was the expectation that there would be a forward advance at both in that generation and certainly in the generations to follow. It doesn't...
That's true, and of course that's what happened when what followed was an expanding economy, opportunities in the manufacturing sector that didn't require a ton of education. So the history of our country was, in a sense, fortuitous for those immigrant groups of the period you just mentioned, because we had high growth rates following the world wars, and they were able to kind of jump on that train and ride it for all that it was worth. And that is the origin of the modern middle class in many ways. But we now have an economy in which those who don't get a lot of education are really on the losing end in terms of income, life chances, occupational mobility. In all respects, things are harder for them. So if your kids are not doing well in school and they don't get a fair amount of education, the likelihood they will repeat the experience of that earlier immigrant wave is much less than it would have been 30 years ago.
The book you co-authored, Catherine Newman, is The Missing Class, Portraits of the Near Poor in America, and they're actual portraits. They're real flesh and blood people. How does one find the missing class, the near poor in America?
Well, I found quite a few of them here in New York City by sort of studying people who lived in three neighborhoods, a Dominican neighborhood, a Puerto Rican neighborhood, and a black neighborhood in New York, who had participated in an earlier study that I won't go into the details for, but they were working in the hospitals, in the transport industry. They were basically service workers, and the most successful of them had found unionized jobs, and so they were, for the first time often in their lives, making a decent salary and often claiming benefits, which were really very important to them. You would find people in the missing class from lots of different directions elsewhere in the country. And in fact, it's probably important to note that people can rise into the missing class, which is what I was really looking at, or they can fall into it, which is something I've studied in earlier books, that is, people who once had solid, secure jobs, especially in manufacturing industries, who have fallen down into this group. I've studied that problem, which we might call downward mobility. But the missing class that I'm talking about here is defined by income, and I found the people who ascended to it from much tougher backgrounds.
Mm-hmm. I also meant, though, actually, how did you find the actual people? I mean, how does one, do you go up to somebody and say, are you near poor? I mean,
no. No, these people participated in a research project that I worked on that took 7 years to complete. They started off by responding to a survey that was done of 900 people here in New York City in these three ethnic groups. And then I just selected a subgroup in a random way so that they would be representative of those 900 people. And then I got to know some of them, the nine families that appear in this book, very well over the course of the next 6 years. And I picked the nine families who appear here because they exemplify certain problems that I really wanted to explore. For example, I wanted to look at the problem of gentrification and how it feels to be in a neighborhood that suddenly is discovered as a desirable place when, for many years, when you lived there, it was a forgotten land. I wanted to look at people whose kids were young and coming under the strictures of the No Child Left Behind Act in New York City schools, where these high-stakes tests would determine their future in the third grade. I had known them since they were very little, and I wanted to understand what it meant that their parents couldn't really help them in the way that the schools assume they will, by taking them to the library, by reading to them, by hovering over them while they do their homework in order to prepare them for those high-stakes tests. I wanted to look at the families I knew who had teenage kids who also were suffering from kind of the deprivation of their parents' time. I wanted to look at people who had fallen into this earlier study who were ill and who were confronting these questions that arise not so much about the uninsured but the weakly insured, the poorly insured, people who had catastrophic level insurance but nothing else, because illness rates tend to be high in the missing class. These are people who lead high-stress lives, and that surfaces in the form of health problems that are more pronounced and longer lasting than it would be true in the middle class. So that's how I found them. They mm-hmm. originally cropped up in a survey research project that the MacArthur Foundation supported and that I participated in, and then I followed them through these other means.
Did you get a sense of their motivation? I mean, on one hand, it's kind of odd to be the subject of a study, I sort of get the idea when I've talked with other authors that have done other work with people not like them, that that people are sort of counting on you in some ways to speak for them.
Well, I think there's some truth to that. I don't know if these folks really completely understood why I was doing what I was doing, what it meant to participate in a study exactly, although, you know, one always has to explain it because that's an ethical responsibility for a social scientist. I will say this, though, the great secret to success for a social scientist like me is that ordinary people really appreciate the opportunity to communicate the way the world appears to them. People very rarely ask their opinion about anything. Politicians don't ask them. Teachers don't ask them. The police don't ask them. So if a social scientist comes along and says, I really would like to know what your life is like, what your experience has been, what problems you face, they appreciate the opportunity to kind of unburden themselves. And, you know, we live in a culture in which people do this a lot in the media now. You can flip on the TV station and find plenty of examples of people confessing really very intimate details about their lives. So in some ways, I think modern America is uniquely predisposed to make this kind of social science inquiry possible because people are accustomed to talking about themselves more than might have been true 50 years ago.
Yeah, the confessional culture.
Right. Of course, that's not what these folks were doing with me. They weren't confessing anything, but talking about their lives and how what they've experienced and what sort of hardships they face and what dreams they have, that they appreciate the opportunity to do that.
Joining me on the Peter Werbe Show is Catherine S. Newman. She's co-author with Victor Tanchen of The Missing Class, Portraits of the Near Poor in America. It's published by Beacon Press. Beacon.org is where you can find a link to it, or Amazon.com, or my website as well. The foreword is by Senator John Edwards. How did that come to be?
Well, as you probably know, John Edwards has staked his campaign on questions of poverty and the fate of low-income Americans more than any of the other Democratic candidates. I think this has been a hallmark of his campaign, whether or not he thought it was a winning issue or a politically successful strategy. It's just something that he really believes in. And I came to know Senator Edwards because I visited the poverty center he founded at the University of North Carolina and spent some time with him talking about these issues from a very serious research point of view long before he launched a candidacy. But once he did become a candidate and made the question of poverty so central to his campaign, I was very gratified by his interest in this research and hoped that, you know, he would find it useful in his pursuits and that he would help, in a sense, to continue to put these ideas before the public. And I'm very proud that he contributed this forward, and I'm proud to be one of his supporters.
I was going to ask you about that. Also, it occurs to me now I probably have to offer time to all the other Democratic candidates. That's okay. Hey, Hillary, Obama, come on. Come on down. But you've answered my question, though, in fact, in your answer and what you just said. Since he's a wealthy man, there's a tendency to doubt his sincerity because he gets, I don't know what, however, his haircut costs. I mean, what a political system we live under.
Yeah, I must say that, you know, those of us who have spent a lot of time, as you have as well and your listeners have, thinking about what kinds of political candidates make a difference for ordinary Americans, all we have to do is cast our minds back to Franklin Roosevelt, probably the wealthiest man who ever served in the White House, and I'm sure was no stranger to elegant clothing and fancy people, and I have no idea where he got his haircut or even if he had much hair, but, you know, Franklin Roosevelt was a very wealthy man, but in the history of our country, no one has done more for the poor, ever, than Franklin Roosevelt did. So I find these questions about haircuts and so on just monumental distractions, launched, I think, by people who really don't want these serious policy issues to be front and center.
I was going to say, purposely so.
Well, I have to conclude so because I can't believe we're really going to let elections pivot on things like haircuts. If we had done that in the 1930s, we wouldn't have had a New Deal. We wouldn't have had Social Security. We wouldn't have had any of the things Franklin Roosevelt stood for, even though he was himself a very wealthy man. So I really don't care where any of these candidates get their haircut or where they, what kind of house they live in. The only thing I care about, and the only thing I think the American people should care about, is what are they going to do for the country and whose issues are they paying attention to? And are people like those in the missing class who really represent both the promise and the peril of the country uppermost in their minds? And for my money, John Edwards is there, and I don't know about the others.
Mm-hmm. Well, Catherine Newman, you're a professor of sociology and public affairs, so whereas it's often sociologists study social phenomena and record it as data, you link this to public affairs. I mean, how are we going to have a country where people don't have to work three jobs in order to, quote, make it, right?
Yes, I think that's a very fair question and one which, you know, increasingly ordinary Americans are having to confront. And I hope we keep those issues front and center when we think about the future of the country.
Let me just, okay, I guess you were stopping because I was going to pose the question a little differently. There was a point, and I can't remember exactly where it was, but President Bush was somewhere and he found out that some woman was working three jobs and he said, "Isn't that wonderful? Let's give her a big hand."
Yeah.
And there is the sense, though, in embedded in the American, maybe even mythology, that hard work will advance you, and that this, in fact, is good, that we're not being given this, that we're not, we're not inheriting, it's not inherited wealth, it's not, it's somebody that clawed their way up from the bottom, and that's to be admired, not to criticize.
Well, I do think hard work matters, and I think everybody in the missing class, not to mention those I've studied who are in poverty, agree with this. After all, they do work very hard, and they believe in the value of work. They are not a separated subculture, as is often portrayed in studies of the poor, of people who somehow reject the idea of the honor of work. I think they are very mainstream in this respect. Most of the people I've studied, whether below or above the poverty line, would agree with the view that working is an essential aspect of dignity for adults in America, and it's where everybody should be headed. That doesn't mean that they're earning enough to reap huge rewards, but But very, very few people in the United States, in the adult world, have never worked. I mean, it's so tiny. It's infinitesimal. What we see instead are a lot of people who are in and out of the labor force, who may have to stop because they've got a sick kid or a sick elder in their family. So there are problems of poverty, serious problems of poverty among people who work year-round and full-time in the United States. The people in the missing class are above that line, but they would join with virtually everyone else in subscribing to the idea that work matters, and that you are responsible in that sense for your own fate, and that you owe it to yourself, mm-hmm. and to your children to be in the labor force. That doesn't mean that they're happy to be earning lousy wages.
Sure.
And it doesn't mean that we don't need to attend to the shortfall that develops in any family that's earning such modest amounts.
Well, Catherine Newman, in just about 90 seconds, public policy, public affairs, how do we reverse a situation where all the newly created wealth is only going to the high side, and that there's even some doubt whether middle class, let alone the missing class or the poor, are going to do any better in the next generation? Where is the solutions lie in a very...
That is a big question to answer in 90 seconds.
Well, you got 60 seconds now.
You hit a huge nail on the head that rampant inequality is a serious problem in the United States. For the missing class specifically, I think there are important things we can do. Universal, high-quality, early childhood education is critical. It helps to level the differences between families, which create unfair differences between children. If we step up in the public policy realm and in education reform and make early childhood, high-quality early childhood education available, we will blunt some of those differences. I think access to higher education is critical. All of these people know, and their children know, that if they don't go to college, their futures will be bleak. But we're making it more and more difficult for people to do that by jacking up public university tuition, and that eliminates the missing class. I think we need to do as much as we can on health care, but I'm sure your listeners are already aware of that.
Sure.
These are the sorts of changes that we need. We need better stores locating in their neighborhood that will provide them with more nutritious food at lower prices. These are the people who are caught in the subprime lending crisis. They need protection and regulation so that they're not at the mercy of predatory lenders who will take their houses in a half a second if they fall behind on usurious mortgage payments. So there are things that we can do to assist them in their own quest for upward mobility and stability in their lives. This is hardly a hopeless case, and in fact, their lives are testament to just how much hope we really should have.
Well, I want to thank you so much, both for your book and for being on the show. My guest has been Catherine S. Newman, and she's co-author, along with Victor Tan Chen, of The Missing Class, Portraits of the Near Poor in America. It's published by Beacon Press. You can go to beacon.org. You can also go to my website, where I'll have a link, at peterwerbe.com. Catherine Newman, thanks for joining me on the program.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Riff Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit.
Every day, doctors at Mount Clemens Regional Medical Center save lives and renew hope with skill, talent, and the latest tools. Using robotic technology, a great surgeon becomes something better. High-definition 3D magnification and precise instrumentation increase accuracy, leading to better outcomes. With robotic surgery, incisions are just 1 centimeter long, reducing pain and scarring and lowering the risk of infection. Smaller incisions also mean shorter hospital stays and a quicker recovery, so you get back to normal activity sooner. Expert surgeons paired with advanced technology to go beyond human limitations. At Mount Clemens Regional, we're making better doctors better still. Visit mcrmc.org to learn more about robotic surgery at Mount Clemens Regional Medical Center, a McLaren Health Service. Better doctors,
better care.
Big Daddy here with RJ from Arbor Mortgage. RJ, it's so difficult for people to save money these days. Credit card payments, adjustable rate mortgages, gas prices keep going up. It never seems to end. You speak with homeowners every day. What do you tell them?
Well, we tell them to take action. Those who take action can start saving. For example, we had a call from a local homeowner who was tired of struggling. He had too much going out each month and needed to cut expenses. He went to arbormortgage.com and told us about his situation, and in 7 days, he received a consolidation loan that saved him $396 per month. Folks, this happens every day. If you're a homeowner living paycheck to paycheck, let us know about your situation. You, too, can become an Arbor Mortgage success story.
You heard, RJ. WRIF listeners, take action today. Call 877-90-ARBOR or go to arbormortgage.com. That's 877-90-ARBOR or arbormortgage.com. Arbor Mortgage is here to help.
This holiday season, chances are you or someone you know will face the difficulty of buying a gift that may go unwanted. That's why Caesars Windsor created the Play for Presents promotion. Play every Sunday from October 19th to November 16th and earn up to 7 times your base reward credits for items like designer handbags or an HD camcorder. After all, earning a gift will still buy you someone's love. Must be 19 years of age or older to participate. Official rules available at the Total Reward Center.
The 2008 March of Dimes Signature Chef's Auction is Monday, November 10th from 6 to 9 p.m. at the new Westin Book Cadillac. Don't miss this amazing annual event that pays tribute to the culinary distinction of some of the area's finest chefs while raising money to support the March of Dimes mission of saving babies. Sample specialties while bidding on enticing silent auction packages. Participate in a unique live auction with exclusive packages from featured restaurants and one-of-a-kind travel packages. Tickets are $125, tables of 10 available. For info or to purchase tickets, contact the March of Dimes at 248-359-1553.
This Saturday, don't miss the indoor used vehicle blowout. It's for one day only at two incredible locations. Sarah Buick Pontiac GMC Cadillac at M53 and 30 Mile Road in Washington Township. And Sarah Toyota on Grand River east of Drake in Farmington Hills. This Saturday from 9 till 6 at each Sarah location. Prices slashed on more than 200 used cars. Save on budget vehicles under $3,900. Get payments as low as $97. A month. Finance rates as low as 3.9%. Get on the spot credit. All credit applications accepted. Plus, push, pull, or drag your trade-in. It's worth a minimum of $1,000 with any used vehicle purchase. And get this. This Saturday only, a Sarah Fastlane oil change is just $7.95. Most makes and models. Don't miss the indoor used car blowout at two great Sarah locations. Sarah Buick Pontiac GMC Cadillac on M53 and 30 Mile Road in Washington Township. And Sarah Toyota on Grand River East to break in Farmington Hill. Remember, it's happening this Saturday from 9 till 6.
Back to rock. Listen.
Everything that rocks.
Mother, tell your children not to walk my way. Tell your children not to hear my words, what they mean, what they say, mother. Mother, can you keep them in the dark for life?